Next is the Committee on Health and Human Services and Housing. It is about 1:10 or 12:10, excuse me. We're not that late. In room 123. Okay, this afternoon we have a full agenda, so let's begin with Senate File 831. Senator Conan, is he here? Great, there you are. This is Medical Assistance Critical Access Dental Providers Criteria Expansion. And it looks like Dale Husted is here as the Chief Administrative Officer for Rice Hospital. Welcome to the table. Do you have any amendments to add to your bill at this time, Senator Conan?
Madam Chair, no, I don't. Just the bill as it is before you. And thanks for hearing the bill also today, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Please begin.
Okay. Madam Chair and committee members, Senate File 831, what it does is allow the commissioner to designate a city-owned hospital, and Rice Memorial Hospital in Willmar is a city-owned hospital. It allows that hospital to be a city-owned hospital-based clinic as a critical access dental clinic. And what it'll do is these clinics then are given an increase of 30% reimbursement rate from the state for MA. And in the bill itself, it's just a two-word change on line 2.7 on the page 2. It just adds the word city or, and then it goes on to say county-owned and operated hospital-based dental clinics. And so that's the bill, and Mr. Madam Chair, and my testifier is Mr. Dale Husted from Rice Hospital, and he's the Chief Administrative Officer there.
Thank you. Mr. Husted.
Yes, thank you.
You can say you have to introduce yourself and very good. Helps thank us for the committee to chair. Know your voice.
Yes. My name is Dale Husted. I'm the Chief Administrative Officer at Rice Memorial Hospital in Willmar, and I'd like to give you a little bit of background about the Rice Regional Dental Clinic and the request for the change in this bill, for this bill. Back in 2007, Rice Memorial Hospital built the Rice Regional Dental Clinic as a cooperative project with the University of Minnesota School of Dentistry. Rice Hospital owns the dental clinic. It's a department of Rice Hospital. And Rice is a city-owned hospital in Minnesota. We work with the University of Minnesota School of Dentistry in that they provide third-year students from the School of Dentistry to provide care as part of their clinical experience in the School of Dentistry. Rice Hospital provides the staff, the dentist who is the dental director who oversees the care, the hygienists, the nurse, dental assistants in providing care for those patients. Most of those patients come from a 17 county area. We do care for about 7,500 different patients a year, about 18 or 19,000 different procedures. The majority of those are patients who have not seen a dentist for many years. A lot of kids. A lot of elderly, those who are on medical assistance, those who are uninsured. And so we intended to receive designation as a critical access dental provider, and we applied for that through the State Department of Human Health. And we were informed that you do, in fact, meet all of the criteria for critical access dental provider. With one exception, you are not a county-owned hospital. You are not a 501c3 nonprofit hospital because you are a city-owned hospital, and you are not a department of the University of Minnesota. And those are the criteria that we need to use in order to designate you critical access dental provider. And so we were denied receiving that designation. We asked the Commissioner of Health if we could receive a waiver, and we were given by the commissioner approximately a one-year waiver to receive those designated funds through the end of June, with the idea that we could ask the legislature to add city-owned hospital to the bill, to the law, so that we would be able to receive that funding, additional funding in the future. To our best knowledge, we are the only city-owned hospital that has a dental clinic in the state, and we are the only one that we understand that provides care that would meet the critical access designation for underinsured and uninsured patients.
Thank you. Thank you. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on this bill? Okay, this would expand to Rice Memorial Hospital, a city-owned, it really is a city-owned hospital, it's not specific to your hospital, access to a 30% higher reimbursement rate for medical assistance clients served. My one question, if there are no other questions, is there, first of all, dental rates has been an issue under any circumstances for the adequacy of the reimbursement and the stress that it's putting on the ability of persons on MA to have access to this dental services. So setting that aside is another issue for another day. If that's not resolved somehow, the rate paid to dentists, as we add to the MA, increase the percentage of reimbursement rate for MA, does that have a consequence of further reducing the reimbursement rates for all other dental services?
Are you asking me?
I'm asking if you know the answer, either of you, if you know the answer to that question.
To the best of my knowledge, not receiving this designation would not change the reimbursement otherwise. It would further reduce the revenues that the Rice Regional Dental Clinic has. And if I could just add, we designed the dental clinic specifically to reach people who have not been reached for dental care. And so the vast majority of our patients, we do not have dental insurance to cover them, for example. And so we have a sliding fee scale, and we in a sense, take whatever we are able to get for that care. Consequently, for those patients in a year's time, in 2012, for example, we were about $300,000 in the red with that operation, even with receiving the critical access designation for that short period of time. So our regional dental clinic really has a mission to look for ways that we can close the gap and through grants and gifts to be able to break even, to be able to provide for those patients. But I don't believe that without this designation that the reimbursement would be different than it would for any other non-designated provider.
I don't know. Is there anybody? I would even look at you, Senator Laurie, if you may not know the answer to this question either. What my question is you take more of the percentage for reimbursement for a certain population that has this designation for good reason. That's not the argument. Is it like one of those situations where we're paying more here, so it stresses an overall sum of money and then forces us into a reduction overall for reimbursement rates?
Not, Madam Chair, not within the pool of dental. I mean, you know, if we increase funding anywhere within the HHS budget, of course, it has to be fit within the target that we get. And that's a dynamic that we're always familiar with and struggling with. But there's also, I thought your question had been, there was a proposal by the governor to increase dental rates both in fee-for-service and PMAP by, I think, 5%. We're going to take those seriously. We're going to look at those as well. And my understanding of how critical access works, you know, the critical access providers would get that as a base rate, but then it's an add-on of whatever the Medicaid rate is. So if we increase the Medicaid rates generally of for dental services, it helps the critical access, even if we don't expand it to include folks like this. But it is but it is additional budget pressures, and we will try very hard because I think that some of the pressure that we've put on the critical access system, that it was a very well-functioning system in my mind, and I think that the cuts that we made to it over the last several years of budget cutting in the HHS have been really disastrous. And, in fact, I have the very next bill, which is a little bit more modest expansion of critical access, and we'll continue the same conversation.
Great. Yes, I know. And this we can talk about this in finance. It's just that I'm informing Senator Cornyn that what I'm trying to understand, and I'll pay more attention between now and finance, is whether or not it's a finite pot of money. I mean, even with an increase that the governor has, is it a finite amount in the budget that we have for dental services? And then some are getting a little higher reimbursement because of critical access or because of this process that we're talking about here. That means we have to reduce who has access. And the answer to that is no. So the second question I have for you is, you've applied for a waiver, do I understand? Would you talk more about a waiver that you've applied for and its implications in this?
Sure. Back in May of 2012, we asked the commissioner to be designated as a critical access, to receive this critical access designation. We had been informed by the Department of Health that we were not eligible because we weren't a county-owned hospital, et cetera. We asked the commissioner if she could designate us that, and in the letter we sent her, we said we believe that the commissioner had authority under 256B.765C to make an exception and be able to designate us under that authority, and so we requested if she would have the, if she had that authority, if she would designate us as the Commissioner of Health, and of course she responded by giving us an extension of that critical access designation through June of this year, and that was what she was willing to do for us. So
and that's why you are here now.
That's why we're here now, right?
Are there any further questions? We have a quorum, so on Senate File 831. Senator Cornyn renews his motion that it be passed and referred to finance.
I'll make that motion for him.
Oh, excuse me. Join us.
Yeah.
How did you miss the opportunity to be on this committee?
I don't know how that happened.
I talked to Senator Lori about it. Excuse me. Senator Lori moves. Senate File 831 be passed and referred to finance. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay. Passes. Thank you very much, Senator.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Lori is going to be presenting Senate File 123, Critical Access Dental Provider Requirement Modifications.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Excuse me. Michael Flynn.
Yes.
Yes, we have another critical access dental bill before you here. This was brought to me by a private practicing dentist. Again, as we just described, the critical access dental program has been seriously curtailed over the past few years, and it's gotten to a point where a lot of really incredible resources, particularly in greater Minnesota, have been cut to the point where they're not viable business operations any longer. And I think that the case for expanding eligibility for the critical access dental program for these really core private dentists out there doing the work that the state really has a need for and a real benefit if we can get these individuals served. So what this does is, if people want to read it in the bill, you'll see the criteria, and you had to fit in one of five different categories in order to meet the critical access provider standard, you know, nonprofit community clinics. We heard about county-owned and operated hospitals. The last one was largely about expanding that component to city-owned hospitals, FQHCs, and rural health clinics. But private dentists were completely left out of that, and it's been problematic for a couple of them. So what this does is it allows a private practicing dentist, if the dentist's office is located within a health professional shortage area outside the seven-county metro area, so it's a rural one, more than 50% of the patients are uninsured MA or Minnesota Care patients, and the dentist does not restrict access to services, and the level of service provided is critical to maintaining adequate levels of patient access within the service area. And so it's a pretty modest expansion. It probably would not cover too many private practicing dentists, but for those that are operating, they are a really core piece of our safety net out in greater Minnesota to ensure access to underserved populations. And with me here today is Dr. Michael Flynn to kind of help underscore the need for this modest expansion.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, I'm Mike Flynn. I happen to be the president of the Minnesota Dental Association this year. However, I am a former critical care provider. In fact, I was a critical care provider on the very first time it was offered. However, in 2010, I was removed from critical care. My practice was the only general dentist in four counties that was designated a critical care provider. For those who don't know me, I know Senator Carlson knows me, or Nelson, Carla Nelson, rather. That would be Houston County, Fillmore County, Winona County, and Wabasha County is the area that my practice covered. And we saw over 3,000 patients on Minnesota Healthcare. I heard the gentleman from Rice Hospital state 17,000, but in my small practice, I think percentage-wise, I'm an authority on where critical care has been and some of the downfalls, and I'd like to cover that just a little bit. The Minnesota Dental Association doesn't oppose any effort to improve the ability of dentists to deliver and provide care. I appreciate Senator Lori's concern and dedication to this problem. In fact, when he authored this bill, I think he probably had my practice in mind. I fit exactly who he was targeting. But as he stated himself, it's only a modest number of people that will be able to be providers under this bill, and that's where my concern is. Senate File 123 applies only to a very small group of eligible dentists and clinics. In my mind, being a critical care provider in the past, it will not fix the large problem at hand, but it probably offers maybe a Band-Aid to a hemorrhaging problem that, Madam Chair, you suggested at the other bill just before us. You had concern there. And I do want to point out, I feel there is, at this time, only X amount of money in the budget. You suggested, will this affect other providers? Probably it would. I'm not sure. But I just want to make that clear as a point as I thought about it. I also want to point out that recently, last Friday, a week ago, the Office of Legislative Affairs put together a very detailed report which I concur with, and if you haven't had a chance to look at it, I would recommend you review that. As the Office of Legislative Affairs reported, there's a myriad of payment policies and programs that are poorly coordinated and inconsistently applied and likely have had a negative and opposing outcome on dentists and programs. As you just heard from Rice Hospital, that is exactly what the Office of Legislative Auditors was trying to point out. What we need is a more broad-based, holistic solution that is truly will repair the program and provide access to patients. Across-the-board increases are what we really need. But I appreciate, again, Senator Lurie, to look at any intermediate programs that might help us. So thanks again. The Minnesota Dental Association, what we're looking for is upgrading the base fee schedule. As many of you know, probably all of you know, our base fees are from 1989, and there is a bill that we support, they'll move that up to a base of 2011. In summary, this change will only help a small amount of dentists, and it wholly is inadequate, as I think our author appreciates. The Office of Legislative Affairs reported that significant systemic changes, including significant increases in reimbursement, are necessary for all dentists, so Minnesota patients truly have access to care, and that would mean even for basic services. We're looking to try to get basic services to people who need them. Again, I thank Senator Lurie for his proposal, but I respectfully submit that this is only addressing the root of the cause and a little bit of the Minnesota dental access, and I commend him for bringing this forward and recognizing the need. We need a comprehensive overhaul to MA reimbursement. The system in Minnesota, which will help all MA patients who are right now have problems finding places to go, especially in greater Minnesota. We don't have quite the opportunity that we have in the Twin Cities for access to care, and that is really illustrated by Rice Hospital saying that, I believe he said, over 7 counties, or maybe it was 17 counties. Is the gentleman still here? But it shows that the great transportation and effort patients need to go to receive dental care needs to be looked at in a bigger picture. But I appreciate the effort to look at all possibilities to improve dental access. So I thank you for your time. I thank Senator Lurie for his concern and interest, and I'm here to answer any questions if you have them.
Thank you, Dr. Flynn. Senator Lurie?
And Madam Chair, I'd like to thank Dr. Flynn for making himself available today. And he did highlight, a broader need for addressing the issue of Medicaid rates for dental providers, as was clearly highlighted in the OLA report that we did receive just 1 week ago. And I want to assure members, I in no way intended for this Senate File 123 to be a complete solution. But even if we are able to add something to the base payment rate for dental services broadly, it probably still won't be able to be enough to bring these critical access providers up to a level where it's a viable entity going forward. And so adding the component of Senate File 123 should be in the mix for consideration, as well as additions to the base, which are incorporated in the governor's budget, and I'm carrying them as a chief author there as well. Modest as they are, that's what we have. And I know there's other bills as well that I think are going to be coming to the Finance Committee. We're going to be getting out of policy mode into next week, have a slight little break, and we're going to be going full tilt trying to put together a budget for the end of May. And would appreciate member support for Senate File 123. When the time is right, I would move that Senate File 123 be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Finance.
Thank you. Senator Lurie, is there any further discussion from the committee? Seeing none, all those in favor of the motion, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed, say nay. The passes. Thank you, Senator
Madam
Lurie.
Chair and members. Thank you.
I have no idea what's going on.
Senator Eaton? Senator Eaton here?
State government.
I guess she's in state government.
She's in state government.
Senator Hoffman. For those who are here in the audience today, I'm sure you already know this, but we hope to stay with our agenda, but our committee members are serving on multiple committees that are meeting during this same time in order to meet the deadline dates. So we're all coming and going in order to be able to present in other committees. And that includes me. I am also in judiciary right now.
Gee, I hope to be able to.
So I will be coming and going as well, but that's what's happening here, and we had a quorum, so we can move ahead on these bills. But the presenter, like for Senator Eaton, is in state and local government right now presenting a bill. So when she gets back, we will be taking that issue up. So for now, we're going to move with Senator Hoffman, Senate File 762.
Thank you, Madam.
Go ahead. Excuse me.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I do want to present, first of all, an amendment, 762A1. And it's real simple. This language gets it put into the way the bill should be read.
This is in the members' packets. This is your first committee, correct?
Yes.
So it is an author's amendment. So all those in favor of the A1 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, say nay. Passes.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Medical assistance, Senate File 762 I'll give you a little background, and with me is today is Carrie Sheldon and also Ann Henry, and they'll give some testimony, but I'm going to be real brief in the interest of time, seems to be the thing, time management. Medical assistance, MA, requires that people have no more income and no more savings or assets than the amount allotted in law. The new income standard under the Affordable Care Act, called MAGI, Modified Adjusted Gross Income, is income up to 138%. That includes that 5% buffer, or $1,278 and below. Here's the kicker. Different groups eligible for MA have different income and asset limits in state law. The Affordable Care Act raises the MA income limit and removes the asset limit for everyone on MA, families, children, and new adult expansion groups, except persons with disabilities and seniors. Persons with disabilities and seniors will continue to be required to have no more than 100% of the Federal Poverty Guidelines, FPG, which is really $931 a month. And here it is. Or even if one more dollar is income, they must spend down on health care, like a deductible, every month down to 75% of the Federal Poverty Guideline, or down to $698 a month. This group is limited to no more than $3,000 in savings or assets, while the other MA groups will have no savings or asset limit beginning January 2014. So in a sense, Madam Chair, this bill brings persons with disabilities and seniors up to the new MA limit in line with everyone else on MA. And so with that, I'm going to turn over to Ann Henry from the Minnesota Disability Law Center.
Hello, Ms. Henry. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Ann Henry, and I'm with the Minnesota Disability Law Center at Legal Aid. And we represent a variety of children and adults with disabilities, different kinds of disabilities across the state. We really want to thank Senator Hoffman for bringing this bill forward to highlight what we consider to be work yet to do in health reform. We need to, I think, focus on affordability for these people, because our state policy is that we have people live in the community. That's what we're promoting. So we have folks with disabilities and seniors that are living in the same communities, shopping at the same stores, but required to qualify for medical assistance, which they certainly need. They have less money in order to support themselves. Besides bringing people up to 138% of the poverty level, which is the new limit for everybody else, the bill has Section 3, which requires the Department of Human Services to bring back recommendations on how to raise the asset limit, which has not been dealt with for many, many years. And the reason we're dealing with that in that way and asking for recommendations is because under federal law, the group called under Medicaid, elderly and disabled, is considered one, and you're supposed to have one standard for all. But we know many people live in the community and need more assets to maintain their home if they have to fix their roof or whatever. $3,000 isn't going to go far. But some of that group also lives in a nursing home or a group home where their room and board is taken care of. So we see those as two different groups, and we think that something different than has been allowed in the past under federal law needs to be done. So we're seeking recommendations back to the legislature next year on that question. And then Section 4 also asks DHS and this time to seek federal authority. This is one of the oddities that happens when you have a state like Minnesota that's done better than many other states. The Affordable Care Act did something that helps most people under 65 with disabilities in other places by allowing consideration of married couples and income sharing and assets. In Minnesota, we have used something for a while that would allow married couples to be okay even though one needs home and community waiver by disregarding the employed spouse's income and assets and not requiring them to pay for the care of the spouse with a disability. And let me just give you an example of one of our clients from the past. The couple was in their early 30s. They had one child. During the birth of their second child, the mother experienced a very serious stroke, the wife, and became physically disabled. The husband, of course, had a job, and luckily the wife could get home and community services to stay in the family home, and the husband could continue to work to support the children and maintain the home. So we want to keep that current policy in Minnesota, but we are unsure right now because CMS has not given guidance to the states. So we want the state to simply ask, can we keep doing what we're doing? We're keeping families together. We're not in a time of that kind of crisis having people to consider divorce, which that used to be that used to be what happened. We want to avoid that. So we are in strong support of the bill. We know that it's going to cost money. We have to get an idea of what that is by moving on to finance, and hopefully we can move ahead on affordability for people with disabilities and seniors. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Henry. And we also have to testify Carrie Sheldon, who I would like the committee to know was a recipient of a fellowship a couple years ago now, Carrie, here in the Minnesota legislature. She was selected from many, many applicants to take time to work here in one of the Senate offices. I can't remember who your senator was. You might mention that, Carrie. And it's just so that you know that this is a person who's received recognition for, outstanding efforts in terms of advancing what it is that she can do with her life. Setting aside the issue that a disability ought not be the thing that blocks you from doing as much as you possibly can with your abilities. So welcome, Carrie, and remind me who your senator was, and then we'll listen to your testimony.
There was Senator Dahl. Senator Dahl?
Senator Dahl. Okay, great. Thank you very much. Thank you, Carrie. Please proceed.
Okay, my name is Carrie Sheldon. I live on my own in an apartment in St. Paul. I am an active member with ADAPT Minnesota, a disability rights group. I am also a part of the UB the Change program at Community Action Programs, where I work on issues pertaining to people with low income. I am also an advocate, active member of Act for Equity, which is working on issues around the Central Corridor. I am also on the Mayor's Advisory Committee for Persons with Disabilities. I count on my medical assistance to stay healthy and get the personal care assistance services I need to live my life and be a part of my community. Right now, I receive $1,145 per month in Social Security disability, but I don't get to keep that money. I am forced to spend down $426 of my limited income to pay for my health care and PCA services through medical assistance. This means that I must live on $719 a month. That's $719 for rent, phone, electricity, personal items, metro mobility fares, food, and anything else I might need. I'm fortunate to have found a place to live in a Section 8 building where my rent is based off of my income, but without that, I wouldn't be able to afford a place to live. I'm worried about my future because the building where I live is going to be going through a renovation process. The paints and chemicals that they will be using are not healthy for me, so I need to find somewhere else to live temporarily. I don't know how I'm going to find anything I can afford. Like many people with disabilities, I've been working for years to find a good competitive job. The unemployment rate for people with disabilities is 12.3%, and the unemployment rate for people without disabilities is 7.9%. I really want to work. If I could find a job, I could be on medical assistance for employed persons with disabilities, and I wouldn't be forced to give up so much of my income for health care. I hoped my problem would be solved when more people are going to be able to get MA in 2014 through the Affordable Care Act. Instead, I learned that someone with my same amount of income, which is under 138% of the poverty level, who does not have a disability and Social Security, will be able to get MA without paying anything, but I will still be forced to pay $426 because I have a disability. I feel insulted that I am expected to live on even less than other people just because I am a person with a disability who is having a hard time finding a job. This is something you have the power to fix. Please do what is fair and vote for this bill so that me and other people with disabilities are able to access MA without being forced to live in deeper poverty than those without disabilities. I only have 20 years until retirement, and I want the chance to retire with dignity and respect. Thank you for your time.
Well, thank you very much, Ms. Sheldon. Is there anyone else wishing to
Madam
testify?
Chair,
Mary Jo George.
Mary Jo George. And Madam Chair, I just want to let people know that you're the person who put that pageship or that internship piece in part. And so, you know, that was very I remember that 2 years ago. So thank you for doing that. There's a lot of people I know that benefited from that.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Mary Jo George with AARP. I just want to be real brief, but we want to lend our support to Senator Hoffman's bill. I think a big policy change coming down the pike in 2014 is the changes to the nursing home level of care. And as a result of that, I think we're going to see a lot of seniors now having to spend down to 75% of poverty who right now are at 100% of poverty. And so we do have concerns that they may not have adequate resources to live in the community. So thank you.
Thank you, Mary Jo.
Okay, thank you. So Senator Hoffman renews his motion. You are on the committee, correct? I got the right. Am I in the right committee here?
Absolutely.
Thank you very much,
Senator. I
wanted
to be on all those committees, Madam
To pass Senate File 762 and have it be referred to finance. It is a bill that requests the department to make determination for blind and disabled and aged persons under the MAGI formula, which will be applied to others, so that they're treated similarly in terms of assets set aside. And also, you request the commissioner to pursue a waiver from the federal government to increase the asset limit, and also to seek authority to allow persons on community-based waivers, home and community-based waivers, to disregard a spousal's income and assets or to participate in the spousal impoverishment provisions.
Madam Chair, it's the delete the or and insert that got amended to instead of.
Yeah. Okay, great. Thank you very much.
You got it right.
Yes. Okay, that's right. Thank you.
Thank you.
So that's a summary, quick summary of what we're being asked to vote on. Any further discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say nay. Passes. Thank you, Senator Hoffman. Senator Eaton, welcome.
Huh. Thank you, Madam Chair. I have Senate File 1297, and I also have an A1 amendment.
Okay. Is this the first time that you've had this heard? So there's an author's the A1 author's amendment is being offered by Senator Eaton. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, say nay. The amendment passes. Thank you, Senator Eaton. Would you like to describe this bill to us?
I will briefly describe it, and then I will turn it over to the department. Basically, this bill makes technical changes to the statutes governing the Chemical and Mental Health Division's program. The bill includes changes to two programs within the division, Children's Mental Health and State-Operated Services. So I will let the experts here tell you exactly how it does that.
Very good.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Ms. Edwall.
Yes. Glennis Edwall, I'm Director of the Children's Mental Health Division at the Minnesota Department of Human Services, and I have very little voice today. I apologize. But
would you put the microphone a little closer? That might help us then.
I am going to describe the sections that pertain to children's mental health, and then we'll turn this over to Tom Reuter to talk about the sections pertaining to state-operated services. And so the provisions for children's mental health are all found in Article 1, Sections 2 through 6. So that's where I will be starting. And then Mr. Reuter will go back and handle Article 1, Section 1, and the remainder of the bill. The sections that pertain to children's mental health really have three kinds of provisions, a repeal of a provision, several alignment provisions to bring statute into correspondence with recent changes that we've made in the Medicaid outpatient rule, affectionately known as Rule 47, that went into effect January 1st, 2012, and then one very simple correction. So, first of all, Section 2 repeals a provision in Children's Therapeutic Services and Supports, which is the Medicaid rehabilitation option for children. We had a package that could be put together under that, CTSS, or Children's Therapeutic Services and Supports, called a Therapeutic Preschool Program, which was really an attempt to integrate CTSS services with a Rule 33 preschool program. It proved daunting, however, to do that in practice, and for the years that we have had that, since 2003, we have had no providers come forward to actually create such a therapeutic preschool program. And so we are asking to repeal that particular program. The remainder of Section 2 begins some of the alignment that I spoke of, particularly between rule and statute and in some cases, things that had been promised previously in statute that now were fulfilled through the adoption of the changes to Rule 47. So the first of these is clarifying that CTSS eligibility can be based on a diagnostic assessment performed within 1 year before the initial start of services, as opposed to the current statutory requirement of every 6 months. And this is in alignment with Rules Part 9505.0371. I will skip over just a minute. I will come back to another of such alignment. But Section 3 is a recognition of tribal credentials for CTSS and other children's mental health services. And this is simply a necessary correction for the fact that the Children's Mental Health Act had never been amended to recognize the fact that tribes could create their own certification standards for mental health professionals. And two of our tribes in Minnesota have already done that. Section 4 is another provision that aligns statute with rule, in this case specifying a supervision plan for mental health behavioral aids. And the details of that are, as I said earlier, in Rule 47. Section 5 really continues that by clarifying that supervision of a mental health behavioral aid when on site must be face-to-face supervision. And then finally, Section 6 is a very specific, is truly a technical provision, just correcting a cross-reference in 256B.0943 between paragraphs N and O. And that concludes the children's mental health provisions.
Just a question. The face-to-face supervision that emerged because to solve what problem or?
Or just a lack of clarity about whether that was actually what we were requiring.
And it is what was required.
Yes, it is what we were requiring.
Okay, thank you. Okay, please continue.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Thomas Reuter, and I'm the Director of Operations Support for State Operated Services. I will be walking through Article 1, Section 1, as well as Article 2 and Article 3 of the bill.
Okay, thank you.
Generally, this bill updates outdated statutes relating to state operated services, including repealing statutes governing task forces, report requirements, services, programs, and sites no longer in operation. It also adds a forensics level experienced psychologist to the special review board to broaden the pool of qualified professionals eligible to serve, and that is done in Article 1 of Section 1. And lastly, this bill replaces inappropriate and insensitive terminology currently in Minnesota statutes and rules relating to individuals with disabilities, replacing those terms with more contemporary and sensitive language. And Madam Chair, I can certainly walk through each section. I'm prepared to do that, but in the interest of time, perhaps I could receive the chair's direction.
Well, I was just distracted, I'm sorry to say, for a minute, because I just want to raise this to your attention. We are passing legislation related to how we deal with the civil commitment of the sexual psychopathic personality and the sexually dangerous sexual person, and eliminating this special review board, and changing the review to a court process, for you to have a look at that.
Madam Chair, this special review board process is used by individuals who are committed to the commissioner as mentally ill and dangerous.
I'm just wanting to note that that's in this language here, and we may be changing some of this as it relates to the sex offenders program. So it's just to alert you to that fact, and
yes,
we'll be
Madam
checking
Chair.
In to make sure that that's correct.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this might be the place to ask my question as well. I'm curious how or if this Senate file 1297, how does is there language in here that addresses the six recommendations from the Office of the Legislative Auditor report that was released about a month ago in February? There were six key recommendations for state-run services, and I would like to know if they're addressed in this section of the bill. And if so, how?
Madam Chair and Senator.
Yes.
This bill was in the works prior to the legislative auditor's report being released and reviewed by the department. The intent of this bill is really to eliminate outdated statutory requirements for state-operated services. The department is going through a review of the legislative auditor's recommendations and putting together a plan for how to respond to those recommendations. And a number of the recommendations we're in the process of working on presently. It does not, however, respond to that work. We will, as a department, be coming forward next year, potentially with a bill that will respond to those recommendations.
Madam Chair, just
Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a quick follow-up. Thank you for that. And my other question was just briefly then, I would assume that there's nothing in this bill that would be contrary to those six recommendations from the OLA.
Mr. Brody.
Madam Chair and Senator, no, there is nothing contrary in this bill that would be against what the legislative auditor is recommending.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Senator Nelson. Senator Eaton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to add that having worked in the state facilities for over 30 years, I'm particularly excited that they're going to fix this data privacy issue and allow that the names of the people who are in the numbered graves at the regional treatment centers or state hospitals, whatever you want to call them, they're going to allow those names to be released so they can be put on that marker. And I just think it's way past due, and I'm excited that that language is in here. And that's, if you want to read it, it's 14.17.
Oh, yes. For those who haven't been to see this burial site, it's really something to see. And that this initiative over a long period of time, as Senator Eaton is referring, has been an initiative to give names, and it's really quite a moving experience to go to the burial site on the grounds of the St. Peter Regional Treatment Centers. And so if you haven't been there, you ought to have a look. Senator Lori.
Yes. It's actually much broader than just that. It's at all of our RTCs around the entire state. Yeah. Some of them are quite alarming. I mean, they just have a coffee can full of concrete and use their finger to put a number on it, and that's the only marker for these people who
yes.
are
Madam
neighbors.
Madam Chair, sometimes it's really hard to even identify who is in that grave. So it's been even more complicated by the fact that they weren't sure they could even release that information.
Thank you for that, Senator Lori. I am remiss in articulating that. But the point I was trying to make is that you ought to go and see what this is so that you can understand why this is so important if you haven't had a chance to. It's quite moving.
And I would add, there's still a little bit of work left to do in funding the Remembering with Dignity project. It's largely a volunteer effort. I've been working, and we get a little bit of money every year. They're getting very close, and I hope that one day very soon we will have all of these people identified and remembered with dignity.
Yes, that's really fabulous. It's a slow drum roll to the finish line here, but I'm glad to hear that. Is there anything else, Senator Eaton, you want to highlight in the rest of the bill here that you think that the committee interested in hearing specifically?
Madam Chair, it mainly eliminates the references to regional treatment centers that no longer exist and corrects language of different disabilities that are actually pretty offensive.
All right. Is there any further discussion? Seeing none, Senator Eaton renews her motion that Senate File 1297 be passed and referred to Judiciary. Okay, thank you very much.
As amended.
Any further discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say nay. Passes. Thank you very much, Senator Eaton.
Thank you. Great.
Don't mind me.
Mine were moving. Okay, Senator Lori, you're going to begin with Senate File 1158. Is that correct?
That works for me, Madam Chair.
All righty.
And I'm going to let the department do most of the discussion. We had three bills on the agenda, which were excerpts from the larger governor's budget bill.
Excuse me, Senator Lori. We just need to check. Do members of the committee have copies of this
bill? I think
they're
in the folders from the last time we heard them. I think that's what staff did. I didn't.
Is anybody needing a copy of the bill?
I don't know.
I don't have one.
You do not have one? We'll try to get... Can you give me some indication? Are you ready to go here in terms of hearing?
Go ahead. I'll follow. I just don't have one, Madam Chair. So.
What's the number?
The number is 11...
58.
Okay.
And then we'll be on 1159 after that. And neither was in the packet. I thought they were in our folders from the last time they were on the agenda. But
You're counting on people holding it in their folders from the last agenda.
I was counting on staff on putting it in the folder. And I've, you know, it's with some history of being able to rely on staff that I did that. And they're fantastic.
It would have had to have been the staff doing it,
really,
believe me.
Really support us, and I can't say how much I appreciate that. But I mean, I guess just in comments about this, this is one of three segments of the governor's larger budget bill that had significant policy implications that Madam Chair and I worked on to make sure that we had an ability to have an additional hearing in the policy division to give some better insight on what we're working on. Senate File 1158 is really from the continuing care note. It's part of the Reform 2020 package. And we did have a broader presentation from the department on the Reform 2020 components in this, in the governor's whole budget and policy proposals. So we're going to focus this presentation on pieces that are in 1158, specifically the vulnerable adults components, the first contact components, and the community first support services. With me here today is Lauren Coleman, and I know that additional staff from the Continuing Care Division and DHS are available as well. With that, I'll allow them to present the contents of the proposal.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, Lauren Coleman, Assistant Commissioner at the Department of Human Services for Continuing Care. Many of us were here 2 years ago facing a very different environment. But one of the positive outcomes from that session was a look to the future. And so a bipartisan support to examine our long-term care system and propose reforms was a result of that. So I'm going to talk about three, as Senator Laurie mentioned, three of the topics that comprise the broad spectrum of Reform 2020. Why is this so important, especially when we are ranked number one in the country and recognized nationally for our home and community-based system? Demographics. We're beginning the greatest demographic shift in our history. Today, 10,000 boomers will turn 65 across the country. And tomorrow, and the next day, and the next day. Between 2010 and 2030, the population over 65 increases by 107%, and the under 65 population will increase only 6%. The reality is that this year we will add a net 800 people to our nursing facilities and elderly waiver programs. And that will increase to 1,600 people a year by 2020 and 3,000 thereafter. Unless we do something different, we will be unable to face that growing demographic. Waiting lists are way too long for our waiver services. The waivers are great, but it's a one-size-fits-all, and we need to provide more options before the waiver is turned to as the solution. Our system is too government-oriented, too government-directed. For far too long, we have decided what people need and what choices are best. We started down the road of introducing consumer choice, but we still have a long way to go. We lose too many people during transitions, during life cycles and events, not necessarily because of lack of services, but it's often to lack of knowledge of choices or guidance. 18 to 26-year-olds are a great example of that effort, and another is when an elderly person has an acute hospitalization and needs follow-up services. So our approach with Reform 2020, one, intervene earlier, before people need our most expensive services, and sometimes before they even qualify for medical assistance. More supports to keep people in their homes, in workplaces, especially during those transitions in life we will all experience. More individual choice and real opportunity for consumer direction, and beginning with the end in mind, an improved and more sustainable program by 2020. So the first proposal supports Minnesotans at a critical time of their lives by enhancing the vulnerable adult protection system where there is alleged abuse, neglect, or exploitation. As mentioned earlier, the demographics show an increase in the older people and people with disabilities, and most of them will be served in their homes and communities. This proposal simplifies the reporting of incidents and supports counties in responding to those allegations and situations. In 2010, common entry points across the state received 24,000 reports of maltreatment. In 2012, those common entry points received 32,000 maltreatment reports. So we're establishing a common central entry point for reports of suspected maltreatment of vulnerable adults through a statewide toll-free number. And we'd also raise awareness of that single toll-free number. Under the current adult protection system, each county is responsible for receiving and evaluating reports of suspected maltreatment of vulnerable adults 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. So there are over 160 different common entry point telephone numbers designed by counties to submit a report. People and caregivers have challenges and must persist by making several calls to determine the correct number to make a report based upon their county and the time of day. So this proposed centralized database and web-based application of the single common entry point will simplify that reporting by eliminating duplicate reporting for certain providers and allow for a single reporting system to track all maltreatment reports across populations and providers. The legislature has a long history of taking a strong interest in protecting vulnerable adults. It has also recognized the work of the Vulnerable Adult Justice Project and strengthened the laws relating to elder abuse. This proposal drew from that group's recommendations. The proposal also supports counties and their adult protection units. The increase in allegations is expected to continue because of the rising demographics and the increased incidence of financial exploitation. County adult protection units have a key role in investigating reports of maltreatment outside of licensed facilities and for providing those protective services. In 2012, 43% of the reports received by the common entry points were sent to the county adult protection units. The remaining reports went to the Department of Health for situations involving hospitals or nursing homes, or the Department of Human Services, which conduct the investigations for adult daycare or foster care. So we provide some resources to the counties to do the job that we are expecting them to do, acknowledging and strengthening their important local role in meeting the needs of vulnerable adults. The next proposal is First Contact, Simplification, Access, and Transition Supports, and is designed to support Minnesotans in a critical health transition and provide early intervention. Good information provided early to people and their family caregivers helps them make better decisions about their care. This puts consumers more in charge of their lives and their care. So we have several elements to this. The first is pre-admission screening redesign. This is a required screen for anyone entering a nursing home. This proposal streamlines the process and provides earlier access to long-term care options counseling for people in a medical challenge or transition. Options counseling is designed to provide good information and options to people and their families so they can make the best decisions to fit their particular circumstances. So again, streamlining and simplifying, helping people manage their chronic conditions and disabilities. Another element of this proposal is to expand access to transition supports by expanding the return to community model. Under return to community, private paying individuals who have been in nursing homes for over 60 days are offered assistance to return home. It's voluntary, but since 2010, we have successfully returned about 500 people to their homes and to the support of their family, friends, and neighborhoods. This early intervention forestalls spending down of Medicaid eligibility and helps people conserve their resources, in addition to staying in their home, which is frequently their preferred choice. The next element will make available a home and community-based report card that will provide objective information to older adults and people with disabilities and their families about home and community-based services. modeled on the nursing home report card, which has been successful in informing and supporting consumer choice and in creating incentives for service improvements among providers. As, again, the number of people receiving long-term services and supports in the community continues to grow, it makes sense to develop a similar mechanism for home and community-based services. The third topic is the design of the next generation of personal care assistance. It is known as the Community First Services and Supports. The vision for the redesign of PCA was to create more flexibility in services and give those who use the services more choice and control to get the support they need to live, work, and play in their communities. Our services have to be more responsive. What people need for help will change over their lives. We also want to provide the right service without incenting people to use the more expensive services, which sometimes happens now. So what is this reform? This proposal reforms the PCA program to create that flexibility and choice. A significant change with Community First Services and Supports is that while the PCA program helps people with their activities of daily living, that this assistance would then be able to teach people new skills so they can do more for themselves. Our current PCA program is not allowed to do that. It also allows services such as home modifications or technology that are currently funded only through our waiver programs. It offers an option for people to manage their own services by hiring and directing their staff. We will issue an RFP and contract with the administrative financial management agency to manage the payroll, the taxes, provide other employment support for people who choose to hire and manage their own workforce. There will continue to be provider agencies who will employ staff, provide services according to a plan that will meet in people's needs. We will also increase the lowest number of units from an average of 30 minutes a day to an average of 75 minutes a day within the Community First Service program.
Would you repeat that again? I'm sorry. What was reduced there?
Madam Chair, we will be increasing from the lowest of 30 minutes authorization a day on average to 75 minutes for the lower need individuals within the new design of CFSS. There are times when the menu of services through a waiver or disability waivers are needed. Residential support, day services, employment supports. But for many, this new program will meet their needs far better than our existing PCA program. In addition, it does provide a 6% increased federal match on the CFSS program. There are some conditions with that, though. It has to be used for services, and we cannot reduce our own state spending for these services. We have to develop a quality management system similar to our waiver programs, which we have seen as an opportunity to improve quality. Another significant feature is that we are designing Community First Services and Supports with an implementation council, one that has over 50% membership being people who use the services or their families. We are really trying to listen to what people believe works best and empower them. Working through more details, more refinements will be made to reflect the best thinking of the council, and we will need to submit that to the federal government, CMS, which will also include a public comment period through that design. So those are the three topics that are contained within this bill.
Thank you. Would you, just for my clarity, say one, two, three, what the three things are that you were just the highlights, not the details.
Certainly.
The first was?
Is adult protection, redesigning
adult protection.
The adult protection system.
Okay. Second?
Number two is first contact, access, and transition supports. So that's the screening and the consultation and helping more people move out of institutions.
Okay.
And then the third is the Community First Services and Supports Program, CFSS.
Okay, great. Thank you very much. Senator Lurie?
Yes, and as Mr. Coleman stepped us through that, I think it's obvious these are significant changes in a program area, and they are not a lot of work that's required of the broader stakeholder community. And I know that there are individuals that are on the agenda to testify. I've actually spoken with Ann Henry, I believe, is one of them, who has some concerns about CFSS. She's told me that the stakeholder process is working well, and she doesn't feel the need to come up here and talk about it if the committee's running shy, but I believe she's still here if the committee wishes to hear some of these. But these are works in progress. We're moving them forward and engaging all the stakeholders to make sure that what we have at the end of the day is a positive direction in the changes to these critical service areas.
Thank you, Senator Lurie. I think if you just hold a minute, we don't have Ann Henry on here. I know that Mary Jo George also would like to, and we have, were Gene Wood or Alex Bartolik going to present today as well?
I think Mr. Coleman did the presentation.
Okay, so we aren't going there.
Gene Wood and Alex Bartolik would, and I see Mary Jo George with the AARP here, and I know she alerted me that she'd like a minute or two to talk about some of the concerns in specific program areas as well.
And while Ms. George is settling in there, Senator Lurie, this is a finance bill. It's going to go to finance, and there'll be much more. Are you also planning to have some more time for testimony on this bill?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Okay. We will vet it thoroughly in finance as well, and we will foster carefully the stakeholder process that we are working to continue.
Because I think it's important for us to understand the implications of the department's bill on various interests. So we can get some today, and we can continue that conversation in your committee. Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Lurie, this is exciting. I mean, to see some, you know, forward thinking on as far as service and supports to individuals with disabilities. And having said that, I guess I have a few questions. And the first one is
Senator Hoffman. Do you want to ask those questions now, or should I let?
Oh, I can wait. I can send a 3-page. I mean, yeah, I'm kidding. I'm trying to. Be
unless
I can wait.
Okay, I will just complete the testimony then, Ms. George. Please proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Mary Jo George with AARP Minnesota. Again, we just want to say real briefly. Overall, we're very supportive of many of the proposals. The new reform PCA services, the single point of entry for vulnerable adult reporting, and the efforts to initiate the quality reforms, including the report card. AARP did issue, in conjunction with the Commonwealth Fund and the SCAN Foundation last year, a scorecard that showed that Minnesota needs significant improvement in home care quality. One other issue I want to touch on, which Commissioner Coleman has not addressed, is, again, the essential community support services. We're very pleased. This is a limited home and community-based services that offers chore services, personal emergency response system, and homemaker systems. We're pleased that new beneficiaries will be eligible for it, and also seniors who lose elderly waiver but retain Medicaid services. But it's for those that lose the robust elderly waiver services that are now going to be in this standalone $400 a month grant, where we have some concerns. So we'd like to continue working with the department and with lawmakers to look if we could do some additional supports and services to that program, because I think if you look at the data, the utilization data, you're seeing that people are using other services and the average amount is more. Lastly, I think that what we wanted to just say is we think it might be important to urge that there be more effective monitoring and regular reporting on the loss of coverage, the elderly waiver coverage, so that we can make sure that this transition is happening in a good way. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. George. I share your concern, you know, so it's not on deaf ears. We'll be watching this as we transition. That's always with the reform. You know, we want to make sure that in the reform we aren't considering the consequences of the movement from the highly structured treatment into something that's more community-based, and they're not considering all the possible things that drop off of somebody's needs for services. There's not a program there to pick it up. So I'm clear about what it is that you're concerned about, and I know that this conversation has to be, we have to really elucidate that to make sure that we're not creating a problem for a lot of seniors.
Thank you.
Disabled persons. Okay, thank you very much. Senator Hoffman, now is the time.
Thank you. Madam Chair, Senator Lurie, and Mr. Coleman, I guess a couple of, first of all, that 50% mark that you're at is really good. I like to see a good effort toward getting folks that are part of the programs to be part of the solution, and I think that's you should be commended for that. My question is, does the CFSS, which is another acronym we get to have around here,
mm-hmm.
Take care of the ISPs in the does it take care of the MAEPDs and the CACs and the CADDies? I mean, is it what you list them here, and it's great because it also falls in, you got under the Individuals with Disability Education Act, you have an IEP in there. So and I'm not trying to be funny, but I just, you know, I'll have a question, a follow up on the IEP piece, but I see Ms. Bartolik is here, so that's the first question, maybe, Madam Chair.
Yes, please introduce yourself.
My name is Alex Bartolik. I'm with the Department of Human Services. And Senator Hoffman, were you asking about all the different plans that people have and how this fits in?
Madam Chair, Ms.
Senator
Bartolik, when all of a sudden we create this consumer CFSS services-centered, person-centered planning, and, you know, we've had that same with the community alternatives for disabled individuals, the CAC waiver. I mean, all those, you know, is this kind of now saying we're going to take over that and we're not going to have an ISP, an individual service plan, but we're going to have a CFSS plan? Is that – so the answer is yes. The question is yes.
Madam Chair, actually what's happening with another part of it is we are changing how we do assessments and service planning. And we've been working on that for some time. We've beta tested it, and we will be rolling this out yet later this year. But for people in the past had different assessments for different services, and sometimes you would go through multiple assessments and have multiple plans to try to access services. But for people who are trying to access any of our long-term services and supports, whether it's going into a nursing facility, whether it's using one of our waiver programs, whether it's accessing this new community first service and support, it will be one assessment process and one plan. And then through that process, they'll just identify what's the right service, and then we can really focus with the person on what's important to them, what's important to them for the quality of their life, what's important for them to meet their needs, and that will give a better direction, and then we'll be able to authorize the right service at the right time to meet those needs.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Hoffman.
Thank you. That's a yes. I appreciate that. And can I have two more follow-ups?
Yes,
and
yes, Senator Hoffman.
I promise to be brief. You have transition services under the Individuals with Disability Education Act, and also it looks like Section 504 of the Rehab Act is in there as well. Minnesota still has transition services for kids in high school begin at ninth grade or at age 14. Well, 14 to 16, there's debate. This, my assumption is here when you're talking transition, are you going to dig down into that age range, or are you going to wait till these kiddos turn 18 or that they're done with IEP services at 22, because that's there should be, and Madam Chair, if I can just get on something, when a child transitions from kids services to adult services, and I've seen docs show a cliff, and then they show this, its services just kind of fall off from being very, you know, coordinated, comprehensive, and medical home type thing, and mm-hmm. and so I saw that, and it bleeped in me wondering, you know, if you're going to dig down, and what a great option and a great opportunity for transition to really occur. Is that what you're trying to do here?
Ms. Bartolik?
Madam Chair, could you tell me which line number I want to make sure I'm addressing the specific part you're discussing.
It's section 40, it's page 52, and it's going to start at 52.18. And 52.20 specifically says special education and related services provided under IDEA and Voc Rehab Services provided in the Rehab Act. And And that, there's a transition, there's the transition cost in 52.18. And when I see that, I know that by law, if a child is on an IEP in Minnesota, you have to start transition services either by ninth grader or age 14, which is above the federal minimum, which is saying 16. And so are we saying we're going to start that young and be part of that conversation? Because it would be good.
Madam Chair.
Ms. Bartolik.
Our intent is always to focus with the schools and make sure that these transitions are focusing well. Part of what you're referencing is language saying we have to work with the schools so we're not substituting for school services, but we are working with them so that the plan starts with kids young and is able to support that transition effectively. And that is a focus of ours, is how can we work differently with schools to impact that planning for people so that when they leave school, they're ready for graduation and we are sure that we're having good supports.
So, Madam Chair?
Senator Hoffman.
If I understand you correctly, you're saying you're going to wait till they leave school when it would be an important, I think it would be very important, and I'm not talking about providing services, but being there as part of the transition process when a child starts that transition process within an IEP structure that, you know, they're ready to transition into adult services.
Madam Chair, that wasn't what I intended to say. The section you were referring is referring to services and how we manage our community first services and supports. As a state, we have made commitments and we are working on transition, starting with when children are in school earlier, the 14, the 15, in the earlier periods. This is talking about the CFSS service, this new community support service, to make sure we are working with the schools for children when they're in schools and this service.
That's good, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Thank you.
And one more, can I offer
a
suggestion?
Senator Hoffman.
Thank you. Page 3, starting at 3.8, new language on the critical access study. I love this. You're getting to the issue of the Olmstead piece, and Minnesota's got a little spotlight on the Olmstead. I'm suggesting, and I'm wondering why we don't have a report due by, for example, January of 2014. You're shaking your head, so you've already got that.
Ms. Bartolik.
Madam Chair, actually, language passed last year required us to do an extensive gaps analysis across the state. This gaps analysis has been done for older Minnesotans for a number of years. This now is required to be including people with disabilities and people with mental illness, to looking at the services available. We're in the process of doing this gaps analysis. It will both be quantitative about what services are available across the state. It will also be qualitative, and we're commencing a very intensive process of going around the state and learning from different stakeholders and people who use services. That report is due in August of 2013.
And that gap, the gaps that you are looking at, are they? Is it a narrow focus of a certain place along the spectrum of care, or is it very broad?
Madam Chair, it's very broad. It's talking about services. It looks at housing. It looks at transportation. It also looks at services that Medicaid covers, but it tries to look broadly because we are trying to look at what do people need, and the questions of people are really just asking them, what's working for you? What don't you get that you think would help you? So they're very broad questions. It's really trying to look at community capacities to support people across the lifespan. And there's a lot of room for it. So it's focused through counties as well as information from health plans and tribes, but it is trying to look on a community level what's available to support people who are older or who have a disability.
Including mental illness disability.
Yes, yes.
We have this fragmented process of conversations around the Capitol, and so we're talking about the backup in the correction system when they need somebody. They have somebody that's arrested that really has a mental illness diagnosis, has difficulty finding a place for placement. Is that a gap that you're going to be looking at? Is there the concern that there's a backup in the state hospital to be able to get people out of there that don't need that level of care into community-based services because the system isn't developed there? Is that what you're going to be looking at? There's a concern that there's a number of highly intensive treatment programs that are holding patients so nobody can get in there out of the jails. because they can't get them out of there into the community and into something that's more appropriate to the level of need. Is that what you're talking about when you're talking about critical access study? Ms. Bartolik.
Madam Chair, let me comment on that. Those certainly are parts of the system that aren't working as well, and in fact, some of those situations you just described are included in the governor's budget to provide some better support for people who do have the ability to live in the community that are in a state, you know, Anoka or St. Peter, et cetera. Related to this but independent is another process that I think I should comment on, and that is Minnesota has committed to the development of an Olmstead plan, and there is a sub-cabinet who has been charged with that responsibility to document, to study where are people not being provided the opportunity for being included in the community. It has representation from many of the state departments, and that sub-cabinet has begun to meet. They will develop a plan. I understand that there is an interest in providing public input to that plan during this summer, so that by the end of the year we can have some very concrete measurable goals to help us keep track of how well are we doing in providing for community inclusiveness. So that's another process that is also looking at some of these situations that you've identified. The Olmstead Committee that met last year identified some of those situations, and so that will be part of our research.
And will a part of that research or this research involve looking at how we're using our waivered services, how the counties are using the waivered services, where they're being located, who's receiving them, where what groups are being served with them and what are not, and whether or not we need to carve out some very specific waivers for populations who are not. It may be the problem that the waiver is being and not being utilized in a way that allows a person, for example, with a mental illness to have access to community services because they're directed towards a less difficult population?
Madam Chair, that certainly is a major part of it. Looking at the services, which are what the waivers are providing, looking at housing, where people are living, looking at employment supports, how people can access aspect of their life. So it's a broad examination of an individual's life and whether they are having the options that they so wish to do.
Are you directly involved with this process?
Madam Chair, Commissioner Jessen is the member of the sub-cabinet, but we certainly do a lot of the research and the development of the information for consideration.
Well, I'm hoping that you'll communicate to whomever the appropriate person is that I'll be asking very specific questions around the waivers, and not so much the number of waivers, but I know that we've deferred to the counties for the waiver program. I'd like really clear, transparent understanding of across the state about those waivers, who's getting them, how they're being used, and who's on the waiting list, and who are those folks that are not getting supported through a waiver program that we intend to support the mentally ill as well as the elderly and disabled population. So, Senator Lori.
And then, you know, this was a good policy-based discussion behind this, but one of the technical pieces that I think was behind Senator Hoffman's question is when you read Subdivision 2 here on page 3 alone, it's a critical access study. Part of the gaps analysis piece is as was described, but it isn't linked to the report. Right. And it's a good technical catch, and I think one that we should correct and say specifically in here as we move forward, or maybe even we can have something today that says, oh, and by the way, the results of this study will come out in the August 15th, 2013 report. The reason it's not in the report I believe, is because it's a one-time study and the report is a biennial report, and that's why it appeared in a different subdivision. And so it's a good technical catch that I think we can easily accommodate either today or when we get to finance. But we will see the results of that study. Yes.
Senator Eaton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The issue that I'm not sure if I'm hearing addressed is when I'm not here, I'm working in the community as a care coordinator, as a nurse, and I do a lot of referrals for services for either a personal care attendant or a waiver of some sort. And the problem is the screeners are always so backed up that they can't even get screened for up to 3 months, which is routine. I mean, that's not unusual. So I'm wondering how that's being addressed. Or is that not part of this?
Ms. Bartolak?
Madam Chair, we know that that's an issue, and some counties are better able to complete them. That is part of the planning we're doing with counties, because we will be monitoring. We'll be providing reports. While getting used to a new assessment is probably going to be a little bit challenging, so we know that that's going to be a learning curve. But people won't have to have multiple assessments. We'll have a common set of information so the next assessment doesn't have to leave out so many gaps. So the counties are gearing up. We've had a number of counties that are hiring. They also are doing some looks at are there some other services they should contract out in order to have more of their staff being able to complete it. So there's quite a bit of interest in really trying to address it because it does require timely access.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Eaton.
So does this include, for instance, if someone's in the hospital and had surgery, an older person is usually what I'm working with, and they need care arranged for when they go home, now we're having to have, they make that assessment in the hospital, then they go home, and then we have to have an agency come in and do a screening to see what they qualify for. I'm wondering if we can't. Is this going to make it possible to do that at the hospital or one screening?
Ms. Bartolak?
Madam Chair, yes. And there's a number of steps, depending on how much detail you want to get into. If people are private pay, we can do that. If they're public pay, our whole goal is to get information to people early because we want to help them while they're in the hospital get to the right place.
Yeah, my patients are on Medicaid. So
okay.
Thank you.
Well, I look forward to that. We just passed in Judiciary last night, I don't know if it makes it all the way, but taking a look at the, as Senator Nelson mentioned, the report that came out on the sex offenders, on the state-operated services, and a number of things are moving forward even this year in separate bills, but one of the things is the requirement that the civilly committed person be placed in within 48 hours out of a correctional system. And it doesn't necessarily have to be, as is true in all the civil commitment process, the most intensive care place. It can be in a variety of other places. And it's great to put two, you got to have it done in 2 days, but at the end of that, there isn't any place to go. So it backs the system up. I hear the backup of the system here, the backup of the system there, to be able to have great ideas about moving towards these various less costly services, but they aren't developed yet. So I'm very anxious to hear any of the reports that come out that formulate a clarity about what those gaps are or if the backups are not related to resources but are related to processes in our department, what those are. I hope that it's clear and it's forthright so that we can really begin to intervene. Is there any further discussion or questions on Senate File 1158? Is it amended? No. Senator Laurie.
Madam Chair, I'd move Senate File 1158 be recommended to pass and re-refer to the Committee on Finance.
All those, any further discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Passes. Thank you very much. Senator Laurie.
Madam Chair and members. Next is another portion of the governor's broader budget bill. This is Senate File 1159. It's Safe and Healthy Development of Children is the department's title of it. And we have several components in here. quality child care components, the North Star components, and rebuilding an effective MFIP program are the three big areas here. We have Aaron Sullivan Sutton and Jerry Kerber from the department to walk us through this governor's proposal.
Okay, Senator Lori, I know I just want to mention this to the people who are here, and there are several who are very interested in this, some of the components of this bill that have asked to testify today.
Yes.
And I have asked to limit the testimony today because I am aware that the opportunity will be continuing for a substantial amount of testimony in your committee. This is a finance bill. I just wanted to pull up some of the critical pieces of policy for this committee to have a chance to hear them before it comes to your committee. So just for the people who are here to testify or those who may not be able to testify today, be assured that we are offering an opportunity in the next committee for those who are not heard today to be heard in the next committee.
That's right, Madam Chair. Thank you for that clarification. You note that there are many who have just shown up and haven't been available for the testimony on the other bills, and I would reiterate that this is a work in progress. We have a significant stakeholder community working hard with DHS, and I'm involved in it in trying to make sure that, again, these significant changes are well vetted and understood by everyone, and our goal is to make sure that we're moving forward in this critical area.
I appreciate that. And so I've asked for the testifiers who may come at some point to talk about their concerns related to the child care services, for example, that we have received communications. They have a repetitious message to them. So it really is not about the volume of people. Of course, through the emails, it helps, the volume of emails. But here, we just want the issues articulated. You don't have to have multiple people sending the same message. We're already getting that. But we do want to elucidate the themes of concern in this bill, and then there'll be an opportunity later for more persons to testify. So I'm hoping that those of you who are here are not repeating, but, you know, bringing critical points forward for the committee. And with that, we can proceed. Senator Lori, as you choose.
We'll start with Ms. Erin Sullivan Sutton.
Madam Chair, members, my name is Erin Sullivan Sutton. I'm the Assistant Commissioner for Children and Family Services at the Department of Human Services. I'm going to talk briefly about three components of the bill: the Child Care Assistance Program, the Rebuilding an Effective Minnesota Family Investment Program, and North Star Care for Children. And then I will turn it to Jerry Kerber to talk about the child care licensing issues. As you may know, almost half of Minnesota's children arrive for kindergarten not prepared, fully prepared to start school, and low-income single parents rely on child care in order to become financially self-sufficient. Yet rates in the child care assistance program have not increased in years, which affects the quality of care available to families. We are hoping to increase access to high-quality care so that children who will arrive at kindergarten better prepared than they are today, and that low-income parents have greater access to higher quality care. In this proposal, the governor is recommending increasing access to high-quality child care by reimbursing providers who achieve a 3-star parent-aware rating by 15% higher, and those who have a 4-star rating, an increase of 20% above the maximum rate. And I should note that the child care changes that I'm referring to are Sections 1 to 10 of the bill in Section 24. We also want to encourage teen parents to finish their education. This proposal would allow teen parents who are under 21 who are either pursuing a high school degree or a general GED that they would have access to MFIP child care. Currently, they are eligible for basic sliding fee, but it could result in their being on a waiting list, and we believe it's important for them to have access to child care so that they can continue their schooling.
Would you say again, they would be eligible for what?
MFIP child care.
And that puts them ahead on
that
the on
puts
the
them
list.
Ahead.
That's the point, I think,
yeah,
that
so they
we
would
want
be
to elucidate here.
They would be automatically eligible, and they would not be subject to the waiting list.
So that's the critical reasoning, I suppose, behind this, that you want to have them be first in on that waiting list.
That's correct.
Okay.
We also are promoting the opportunity to increase continuity of care by allowing a 30-day reinstatement period for families served by the basic sliding fee so that parents have more time to get the necessary paperwork and documentation in, and they don't lose access to child care. We don't create instability for children by moving them out of care. We also are restructuring the child care rate structure, and currently we have over 2,000 rate cells. We are moving into a cluster basis to simplify the rate structure and also increasing some of the rates so that we assure that we're not decreasing rates anywhere. And then we also strengthen program integrity by aligning disqualification periods in the bill.
By what was that again? By
aligning disqualification periods and withholding authorizations or payments to be consistent with the way we handle in other programs. In the area of the Minnesota Family Investment Program, we're hoping to focus, again, on teen parents as well as improving employment outcomes for families and focusing on outcomes and program simplification. We are working to assure that teen parents have access, as I mentioned, to quality child care, but also that they have access to home visiting through some collaboration with the Department of Health. We are also proposing to increase the disregard when a person leaves MFIP. So currently, we disregard 40% of the family's income. We would propose changing that to 50%, so that will allow for a little bit more money in the family's pockets, and also moving to the family wage level at initial eligibility. And then we are also proposing to suspend the work benefit program to reduce administrative complexity for counties. And as a part of that, we are proposing that the commissioner be authorized to request that Minnesota participate in a TANF demonstration or waiver project, if that's permissible, so that we can really focus on outcomes and getting people to work and not focusing on compliance process measures that are currently part of the work participation rate. And then we have one-time investment to try to focus on improving outcomes for African American and American Indian participants on the program in terms of demonstration programs. The next area I want to talk about is the North Star Care for Children. This is a large part of the bill, but I will try to keep it as simple as possible. Currently, we have three separate programs for children in out-of-home care. We have a foster care program that provides basic monthly rate for children, depending on their age, as well as what we call supplemental payments based on a difficulty of care assessment, which is an assessment process that's about 25 years old, and it talks about how complex or how many problems a child has. We also then have a relative custody assistance program, which provides assistance to families who assume permanent legal responsibility for related children coming from foster care. And that program is supported by TANF child-only grants, and then the state supplements that up to what would have been available to the child had they been adopted and put on the adoption assistance program, which is the third program available to families who adopt children from the special needs children from the foster care system. The problem that we're facing is that the foster care rate is significantly higher than either adoption assistance or relative custody assistance. And in fact, foster care has increased annually because there's a law that requires a cost of living increase. We have not seen increases in the adoption assistance or relative care assistance in over 15 years, I believe. And what happens is when we're asking foster parents to adopt or assume permanent responsibility for children, they're then told that they will have about half and sometimes less than half of the resources available once they make that commitment to permanency. And so we see great challenges for foster parents in adopting children. And this is particularly problematic as children become older. Minnesota's pretty successful in getting kids under six adopted or into permanency with relatives, but that's not the case as children get older. We start to see disparities as children become ages 7 or 8 and higher, as well as that increases and gets worse as children get older, particularly their teen years. We also see a significant barrier for African-American and American Indian children, as well as for sibling groups. And I should mention that African-American and American Indian children make up about 39% of the children who remain in foster care for more than a year. and the disparity in payment is significant in terms of their having the opportunity for adoption.
May I just stop you there just for a curiosity question? For those who are not adopted, who remain in foster care placement, and as they get older and there's not an alternative, they just remain in foster care?
They remain in foster care, but that does not mean that they remain with the same foster parent. We see kids who are in care for long periods of time tend to have move from place to place. We also see poorer outcomes in terms of educational outcomes and involvement in the juvenile delinquency system. We also see for many children who remain in the foster care system, they run away or become homeless as adults. And so what we're trying to do is provide the opportunity for permanent family support for kids so we don't have as many children aging out of the foster care system.
And why is it that... they move from place to place in foster care. If a family is accepted child for foster care, is the family typically saying we can foster children between this age and this age, or is it?
There are various reasons. Some kids have the opportunity to remain in one home. Others do not. And sometimes as children become teenagers and become more challenging, the foster parent is able to say, I've had enough. I can no longer care for this child. And so that's what we do know is that the longer kids remain in care, the more frequent the more multiple placements they have, particularly older children. So what we are proposing to do is to combine these three programs into one program that would create a uniform benefit set that would follow children for children over six. Would follow the child from foster care to permanency with adoption or with relatives if they're not able to be safely reunified with their family. The operation of that program will be fairly consistent with the existing three programs, except it will be seamless for parents. We would restructure the current relative custody assistance program as a means-tested program. We're converting it to what is called kind of guardianship assistance, which allows for us to access Title IV-E funds that were made available for this purpose by the recently passed Fostering Connections Act by Congress. And we would then move the operation of relative custody assistance to be jointly operated by the counties and the state the same way the current adoption assistance program is. We would move to a single assessment process that has been under development for a couple of years and pilot tested that's based on the needs of the child as well as what we're asking parents to do to care for them. And we're also proposing the way we're structuring this with combining the state, federal, and county shares and that it be fiscally neutral over time to the counties as well as the two Indian tribes who are operating their own child welfare systems. Now, I should note that as we're moving to create one program, it means that I should also mention that this change would not affect any child who is currently in care. The program would be effective January 1, 2015. And so it would only apply to changes that were made after that date or for new kids coming into care. We did that for a couple of reasons. One, because we need long enough to be able to begin a new complex program, but also we recognize that we're not able to bring everybody up to foster care. That was simply too expensive. And so there are some adjustments. We look at this as somewhat of a one-time correction. So there is a slight decrease in what would be a foster care basic payment in some instances. And the supplementals, we would go from the complex, what we call the difficulty of care system, to a 10-tiered system of supplementals based on the child's needs. And the highest rate under the supplemental is less than what is available under the current difficulty of care program. And so there's some adjustment to be made there. Now, that is of concern. We did take a look at who, for example, was at the highest difficulty of care in 2011, so we would know what we're looking at. And we saw that 127 children were at the highest level of difficulty of care. Half of those children were only there for a short period of time, and then went to much lower rates. What we did see is of the remaining 60 children, about 20 of them had significant medical needs, and so our proposal would work to make sure that those children have access to the services for kids with developmental disabilities or mental health services as they would currently. So that's the high-level discussion of North Star. Again, the detailed operations are in the bill, very similar to how we currently operate. Again, would be seamless from a parent's perspective, we would expect.
Well, I thank you. Thank you very much. I should have the committee members know that I did ask for high-level kind of overviews for not the detail, the financial detail, because we'll be looking at that in Senator Laurie's committee, but the general course and direction that's being taken is of interest, I think, to our committee if there's anybody that has any questions here at this point on this section. Senator Nienau.
Sorry, Madam Chair, which section are we in right now?
The North Star sections that you're reviewing.
The North Star sections start on page 30. And they include sections 19 to 23, 26, 28, and 33 through 52.
Senator Nienau.
Well, Madam Chair, I think this is in this section. If not, I'll wait.
Okay.
But I did have a question. There was on page 41, line 30. There's extension of guardianship assistance after age 18, and it refers to criteria on page 42, line 16, and then subsequent lines. And I just had a question about that. I don't know the full context of this language. This is a lot of new language, so I'm trying to absorb it. But at first glance, it looks like you could have a 19 or 20 or nearly 21-year-old that could be in guardianship, that they have to be line 42.16, they have to be dependent for care and financial support. And one of the other criteria is they simply have to be employed 80 hours a month, which is 20 hours a week. And in reading this, I wasn't clear. Could you have basically an able-bodied 20-year-old that would fall into this criteria, or is that not possible based on how you get into this in the first place?
Ms. Sexton.
Madam Chair, Senator, this language is based on what is required under Title 4E, the federal funds that are available. So this is intended to allow kids to continue their education or be working part of the time, but it would not be available to somebody who's, I don't believe, I'm looking to John Sellen, if he's here, an able-bodied adult who's able to be independent.
Okay. That was accurately described. I think that the belief system behind here is that simply because someone turns 16 and then they lose all of that support system around them just at a time when if they want to be successful in getting a higher education or moving on, that they continue to need that a sustained support system around them. And that the magical age is it 16 or 18? I guess it's 18. That all the services sort of drop away at that point. And this is an expectation or a recognition, at least, that there are still young people are still young at that point and not able to be just go from a supportive family system out to on their own at that age time. Is that correct?
That's correct. And the federal government and Congress recognized that too many kids were aging out at 18 without any resources available, and they needed to have the same opportunity our kids would have to pursue education and to become self-sufficient.
Okay, great. Any further questions on this issue? Thank you, and I appreciate this conversation. When I was here in my freshman year, I met with a lot of relative custody family members who were very concerned about, because they're seniors, typically grandparents, lots of times, and that they're on fixed incomes or they're trying to move into retirement and they're using their resources to take care of a child that's moved into their home for permanency, that they're not, that their reimbursement was such that they had to draw down on those things. They weren't in their earning years where they were if they had their own children, so they were drawing down their retirement assets in order to be able to provide the support services they typically would do if they were in the income earning ages and parent ages, and that this payment system was really disadvantageous to encouraging family members to step up. So I'm really glad that it's like a huge ship, as somebody described it. These departments of ours are huge, huge tankers, and to get them to turn to be responsive to these things takes time. So this is, I'm in my seventh year, so I'm really glad to see something starting to be put in place around this issue. So thank you.
Madam Chair, you will appreciate, it has been a long time. I think our first report to the legislature recommending something like this was 10 years ago.
So much for speedy, responsive government, huh? All righty. Did you say someone else had? Mr. Kerber?
Madam Chair,
you're going to move to the next section of the bill? Yes, okay, thank you.
Madam Chair and members, my name is Jerry Kerber, and I'm the head of the Inspector General's Office at the Department of Human Services. And the Inspector General's Office is the area within which licensing is located. And so the next section here, which is on pages 8 through 17 of the bill, deals with some child care issues. And the problem that we're trying to solve here with the child care issues relates to what we saw to be an increase in the number of deaths of children in family child care specifically that were occurring over a 10-year period. We were alerted to this through a report that we did at the direction of Commissioner Jessen when she came, saying that she wanted us to sort of do an annual report and see what kind of trends would pop out at you. And that was significant because in the world of us regulators, we tend to look at each tree in the forest one at a time, and we don't really step back and take a look at what's been going on. So we had a surprising discovery in that we were surprised at how many deaths we had actually been dealing with in family child care. And so we looked a little deeper, and we saw that, in fact, the number of deaths had doubled in the last 5 years compared to the previous 5 years. So from 2002 to 2006, there had been 25 deaths in family child care of children. And then from 2007 to 2011, there have been 49, so 25 to 49. And while we were looking at it in the beginning of 2012, there were another 9 that came at us quickly through the first half of the year. And so we had a total of 83 deaths in family child care that was pretty alarming to us. And we were trying to put that in some kind of perspective and take a look at what was going on here. And naturally, as we got into this, we saw that in 75% of them, there had been documentation of an unsafe sleep arrangement. And so in that amounted to 65 of the 83 deaths, there was unsafe sleep arrangement. There was a violation of the licensing standards related to that. And that was pretty alarming. Now, that's not to say that in absolutely every case that unsafe sleep arrangement caused the death, but it was there. And those unsafe sleep arrangements are things that are designed to decrease the likelihood of SIDS deaths and suffocation deaths and blocked airways. And so we thought that was pretty significant. So we were also, another thing we looked at was comparing it with child care centers, because we were wondering, is this an issue in child care in general in Minnesota? And we determined it was not. During that same period, there were 3 deaths in child care centers compared to the 83 in family child care. Now, just to get some basis for that, we looked at, okay, well, what are the number of kids that are getting care? And so on any given day in Minnesota, there's about 90,000 children who may be getting care in a family child care setting. On any given day, there's about 60,000 in a child care center. So there's like 1.5 times as many kids getting care in family child care as there are in child care centers. But when you compare the rate of deaths, it was 28 to 1. So 28 times as many children were dying in family child care compared to child care centers. And so it seems significant. Now, I think one of the things that we admit right up front is we don't know that if we're dealing with different kids. I mean, do different kids with more risk of early death happen to go to family child care as opposed to child care centers? But what we kept coming back to is the fact that in 75% of those cases, there were violations of the safe sleep requirements. And so what we had to do is we had to focus on how do we get providers to be more compliant with that. And so the majority of these provisions that we have here in here are related to how do we enhance compliance. It's enhance compliance to enhance safety, and then to get there, we're looking at how do we become more consistent. We had a number of community meetings around the state, and we, as a result of a mortality review panel that took a look at this, and they came up with, I think, 43 recommendations that you probably heard about. And that was a good prompter for some good conversations that we've had with providers and with parents. And we've had a lot of conversation with providers that have helped guide us to where we are today with this bill language. And while I'll say that, I'll also say that I don't think we're done yet. I think, you know, you're going to hear some testimony today which indicates that there isn't necessarily total agreement on everything. But we have, I think, been seeking to clarify a good number of issues. One of the things that we had heard a lot about was that there was inconsistent expectation throughout the state. County licensing staff complete these reviews, and they do a very nice job, but there hadn't been adequate direction necessarily from the state on how to interpret different sections of the regulations. And so there was a lot of opportunity for sort of little independent interpretations throughout the state. And that causes great frustrations to providers, and you may hear about some of that today. And we're in this whole process, we're looking at trying to eliminate that too, or can't eliminate, but at least reduce it. But so the majority of our proposals then, as I said, are really to get at that consistency. And so to do that, we're going to reinstitute training of county licensors. We used to do that, but because of budget reductions over the years, we had cut back on training of county licensing staff. You know, obviously, you know, that seems like kind of a no-brainer right now. We also want to increase the training requirements for providers. I think one thing that's significant is that in every one of these cases where we had these 83 deaths, providers understood that they were not supposed to be putting infants on their back. They knew that there shouldn't be pillows in the cribs. They knew that there shouldn't be loose blankets. However, they did it anyway for some reason. And so what we think is the answer here is to provide a little bit more training on why you don't do that and what are some alternatives. Some of what we learned in these cases is that when one of the sort of competing interests is that if a child is very, very fussy, I think it's sort of understood that a child is going to probably calm down faster and maybe fall asleep faster and arguably sleep deeper if they're not on their back. If they're uncomfortable on their back, you know, they're going to be loud for a longer time. Sometimes we've heard providers are more tempted to put them on their stomach during those cases. And so part of the training, as we're increasing this training, a big component of that is what do you do when you're frustrated with an infant? What are some alternative ways to intervene in that situation? And so we have some, you know, there are some training increases and actually some specific training courses that we'll talk about. And I'll be kind of general, and then if the testifiers kind of lead us into more specific direction, we can talk about that. We also are proposing that we return to a period where we require a physician's order if we're going to deviate from a child sleeping on its back. We had done that up until 2007, coincidentally, but not with proper authority. We were just requiring it. We came to the legislature looking for the authority to actually require it after being challenged, and it went the other way on us. And so what happened is that the legislature changed it to say the parents could give that consent. And this gets to be a little bit controversial, Madam Chair.
I'm sorry to interrupt. I just want to make sure, Senator Hoffman, are you on? You wanting to ask a question on this right now?
Yeah,
it's okay if you do.
Put me in the queue if that's okay at the end. I mean, it's specifically related to child care licensing and who's going to provide the training and a concern from like Anoka County.
Okay, well, if it's on this section that he's talking about right now, which is that there will be training, you're reintroducing training, and you're going to increase the number of hours of training and who does the training. That's the second component of what you're talking about. So if you want to ask a question right now on that.
Thank you, Madam
before
Chair.
Before we move to the next subject, it'll be great.
Absolutely. Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Kerber, who's going to provide the training?
Madam Chair and Senator Hoffman, there's training that's going to be provided to licensing staff, to county staff, and they'll be provided by the Department of Human Services. And what we're also going to be doing is making it very clear what the official statewide interpretation is on particular issues where there's a lack of clarity. The other training, though, for providers is going to be available, you know, through the system we have now, but it's going to be beefed up. One of the things that we've been talking with providers about is there's an interest in some sort of logical comfort language here saying that we're not going to require this additional training until it's clear that the training is available. As we travel around the state and we've talked with providers, generally providers aren't opposed to more training. But as you get around the state, it's not always equally available. And so the infrastructure for that training is being beefed up at the same time.
Senator Hoffman.
Madam Chair, thank you. I appreciate the fact training is good. There are so many organizations, you know, the Early Childhood TA Center, the National Association for the Education of the Young Child, ATI from Applebaum's, NACRA, I mean, all these got it. Here's a concern from the counties. Anoka County claims to spend $700,000+ just in licensing and what they get back from licensing fees is $75,000. So they're saying they have a cross subsidy, and adding this component on, I just imagine they're going to come back and say, well, we got another cross subsidy added on. So how are you going to address the financial load that it's put on some of the counties? And specifically, I'm just using Anoka County as an example, Mr. Kerman.
Madam Chair, I could maybe have Aaron Sullivan Sutton address that, but the training that's to be provided isn't necessarily going to be a training expectation for the counties to provide. There is some funding in the bill that is to augment the cost of training so that for the provider's end of it ends up being $5 per hour. But there's the training is going to be provided through the resource and referral network that's already in place. And maybe I can turn over to Aaron for more specifics on that.
Madam Chair, Senator, Jerry is correct. Through the Child Care Resource and Referral Network, as well as other existing training organizations, as you indicated, there are a number of early childhood associations that provide training.
So, Madam Chair.
Senator Hoffman.
Thank you. Just still a concern that's going to be out there is the counties are going to see this as another unfunded mandate from the state. Just I wanted to give that as an FYI to you, and hopefully we're going to address that financial issue.
Will that be elucidated, Senator Lori, during your hearing?
Yes, I'm certain we will have a local effects conversation and make sure that
good.
That's
thank you.
Okay, Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have two small policy amendments about this particular section of the bill, and I just want to know if you'd like me to offer those now while we're on this section, or if you wanted
Would you mind holding off? I don't even know why I'm saying that, but I'm wanting to offer the opportunity for the testifiers to come
okay.
up, and then your amendments may make sense in context to that testimony as well. So.
I'll count on you to bring me in at the right time.
Okay, thank you. Okay. And the third item?
Madam Chair, we want to clarify some of the expectations and maybe improve some of them for providers. As I mentioned, we naturally did a comparison between the number of deaths in family child care versus child care centers, and where there's, you know, 28 to 1, 28 times as many compared to 2.5 or 1.5 times as many kids, we looked at, well, what's different in child care center? And that's where we came up with the fact that child care centers do a lot more close supervision of sleeping infants. In a child care center, the baseline expectation is there's continuous sight and hearing supervision. They're in the room with them. That isn't the key, and then if they're not in the room with them, they have to be using a monitor and then checking on the infants every 15 minutes. That expectation is represented in the bill, although it's slightly modified in that knowing that, you know, family child care is a different arrangement than a child care center, and there are kids of all different ages and they're involved in all kinds of activities in and outside the house. What we came up with in here is that for the first 4 months of care, that there would be 15-minute checks on a sleeping infant. And then after that, it's every 30 minutes. But also, if a child has some respiratory distress going on, that they would also be checked on every 15 minutes. You may hear that that's thought to be a bit excessive. When we look at the infant deaths, about 50% of those deaths in family child care occur in that first 4 month period. And surprisingly, a number of them are even in a shorter period than that. But it's during that period of time when it seems to be that the children are adjusting to the child care arrangement most. And so that's why we landed on that. And I think that's probably been one of the biggest points of concern for providers. Not all providers, but many providers. I'm sure you've heard that. Related to that, I mentioned the physician's order. And then some of the training where we had like sudden infant death syndrome training that was required before every 5 years, we're moving that up to every year because it's very specific to the situation. And same with shaken baby training. Instead of every 5 years, it's going to be every year. And there's some other training in there too that is, from our perspective, it's related to helping the provider figure out different ways to deal with frustrating situations. I think we read about one of those recently in the paper where we can only imagine what it's like sometimes for providers. And I think they need more support in that area in the training. So those are the big deals that we've got going here. I'll mention there's also one about insurance. Mm-hmm. We are suggesting that liability insurance be a requirement for family child care providers. It's currently expected, but it's not required. If they don't have it, they're supposed to notify a family in writing that they don't have it. Unfortunately, that hasn't always been the case. And so we're wanting to institutionalize this a bit more. And in some ways, it might be to provide some relief for a parent. We had a sad story about a parent who said he was just trying to recover burial costs for his deceased infant, and he couldn't get that. On the other hand, we're also looking at insurance companies as sort of being a partner here. We know that automobile insurance companies monitor our driving records and accident records, and I think it has an influence a bit on our driving style, at least it does for me. And so it's that kind of notion here that we're also looking for a bit. But that's also a point that you probably have heard and will hear more about. So okay. The insurance and the number of hours, and then the frequency of these checks on sleeping infants.
Okay. Thank you. Senator Benson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Mr. Kerber. I'm looking at, and as you mentioned, the infant sleep supervision requirements are troublesome. Just as a practical matter, every 15 minutes for the first 4 months of care, that seems to be without regard for at what point the child comes into care. It's while they're still an infant, so the child comes in at 11 months. Technically, they're only an infant for 1 month. If they come in at 6 months and they're rolling over, there does clearly need to be some work done here. And then as a practical matter, checking on a child every 15 minutes when you have toddlers eating snacks in the kitchen and coloring, you're just asking for trouble if you're leaving toddlers alone in the kitchen. So at some point, we have to get out of bureaucratic guidelines and look at some reality, because we're piling on family child care providers, it feels like, in some ways. I know you're trying to reduce infant deaths, and I know you're trying to create safe environments, but what also happens is you make it really hard for somebody to do this job. And in places where there aren't large center-based care, out in rural counties, you count on your neighbors in-home child care so that you can go do your job. I am very concerned. I encourage you to keep working on this and to think about what's going to happen if we reduce the number of in-home child care providers, because we just make it so difficult to do this job.
Senator Nelson.
Madam Chair, that goes really to the heart of one of my amendments. So I don't know if you'd like that now, or do you want to come back? I guess
Everybody's anxious to get on these things that we're talking about, that we've heard of, that are concerned about. But we do have some people who came to try to elucidate exactly what you want to accomplish in your amendments.
Of course, absolutely.
So I think we'll go ahead with that, I'd like to be able to move us through this by 3:00, if it's possible. So we have Cindy Cunningham and Katie Chase. Holly Seville and Lisa Thompson are also included, and Haiti Brown.
And we have about 2 minutes each for you in order to move this through. Again, I want to reassure that there's more time for those who would like to testify. But if it would be possible, now listen to each other, everybody. Cindy, Katie, Holly, and Lisa, and Hattie. Listen to each other. We don't need to hear the same message because we know you have a common message. So elucidate the issues for us for today. And I know you've been talking to all of us outside of here. So for our committee hearing, it really helps us if we get the critical issues. Volume is less important, right? Or volume of testifiers, not the volume of your voice. The volume of testifiers is less important than we get the critical message from the child care providers. Thank you. So, Cindy.
Hi, I'm Cindy Cunningham. I am a child care provider in 15 years. I'll try to talk quickly, and the commentaries are in the handouts of the testifying that is handed out to you. I appreciate the ability to speak to the policy instead of just the finance, because this will dynamically affect our businesses. I have this issue somewhat had a self-correcting. It's gone from this 10-year number to one since July of 2012, and I would like everyone to keep that in mind. There's been a lot of work put in by providers. I'm going to skip down to Wednesday when we were supposed to be doing this. There was put in your packets the AAP. Thanks to Senator Eaton and with the Senate File 630, the Physician's Directive is in place. Based through this, incredibly helpful. DHS addressed when children roll over. Counties were starting to say to us, if a child rolls over, you have to turn them back. So now that has been changed through DHS and Senator Eaton's bill. The addition of C is welcomed by most providers that we get to hold. We were told we couldn't hold our babies, and I had a sick child after hearing that at one point, and I was like, now what am I supposed to do? Clarification and consistency needs to be changed, and I believe there's an amendment regarding the age of the child. The age was through 12 months, which technically made it a 13-month-old. By changing it to 12 months, it's consistent, or to the birthday, consistent with all of our other licensing. And there was some wording in 630 that addressed the tight-fitting sheet. I will arrogantly maybe say I was involved in introducing both of those in the House that were brought over to the Senate, so thank you. If the goal, the Section 15 is the toughest, that interrupted sleep, and I'm going to just, you've got my writings in front of you. I know others will speak to it. What I would highly recommend is look at the AAP. There is no direction from the AAP or from a physician's directive at this point that says that that level of monitoring will change or prevent or do anything. You should have gotten another handout. I'm a teacher. This is safe sleep. If we train providers to do this, we do not need to be checking on babies every 15 minutes. When providers have talked and we've listened to professionals talk about the difference between centers and in-home, our babies go into a deeper sleep because they're isolated. I was recently took a wonderful training at a Montessori center. All the babies in the room, none of them go into a deep sleep. In our centers, they go into a deeper sleep. Home, they have their overnight sleep. SIDS happens 2 to 4 months. If you call the National SIDS Center, it's between the ages of 2 to 4 months old is the critical age for SIDS. The second is that SIDS happens during deep sleep. They get a deeper sleepiness. None of that was looked at by the Child Mortality Committee. If any statistics are put forward in support of some of these actions, I would challenge you to ask for the documentation to support that, because the documentation that I've seen for data does not support some of the claims that are done. And I think the caveat from making us be a center and check every 15 minutes is not a practical one by any things. And yes, choking children is not going to be a good alternative. The other piece, I think, is liability insurance. I actually called my insurance company because I got a rejection or a discontinued notice because the company went renegotiated. And I talked to one of the head people in it, and they said that the split of the 100-250 is not a general practice. I'm not an insurance person. It's not a generally offered practice of insurance, excuse me. And they recommended either offering just the one $300,000, this is way over my knowledge, or offer the 100-250 or the $300,000 if we're going to manage. And I hope you guys can understand what that is because I just went over the top of my understanding. The training is a dramatic increase. We share the concern of the counties. The reality is the people who end up incurring the cost
is my business. I'm a child care provider. I'm a self-employed person. I will incur those costs. If the state offers us training money, then that will help in that manner. And I think that the swing for 5 years of SIDS and shaken baby to yearly is a flip of the pendulum swing. Once providers understand this, it becomes relatively simple. I've suggested repeatedly that we include a motor memory. I've put babies down for 21 years. I have a 21-year-old son who is being deployed to Afghanistan soon. I was able to raise him and to go through that. If I've been putting babies down for 21 years, I wrap them up, I put them down. And it took time to make sure that we weren't putting them on their stomachs because that used to be what was recommended. So if providers have to actually display that skill at least every 2 years possibly rather than yearly, it will be a much more practical process of doing that. And
thank you. I'm going to ask you to wrap up so that others have a chance to testify. Thank you. Would you pick up, if you have additional things beyond what was communicated here, which was about every 50 minutes, liability insurance, training, and shaken baby, the frequency with which the training has to occur for shaken baby. So those are the elucidated points so far. I'm sorry, would you introduce yourself?
Yes, Madam Chair, committee members, I'm Katie Chase. I'm the Executive Director for Minnesota Licensed Family Child Care Association, and I will definitely skip over parts of my testimony at your request so it's not as repetitive. But we would like to first thank the Department of Human Services licensing team for reaching out to stakeholders, parents, and providers before developing language for this bill. Communication between our organizations has brought us to a bill that we can almost support. So we respectfully request that the committee adopt the amendments that Senator Nelson will be presenting before you. Primarily because state, as Mr. Kerber indicated, statewide inconsistencies of county licensing interpretation is rampant. We request that language be added requiring DHS, and I don't believe this is in the bill right now, and so we need this in there, that DHS train all licensors on the interpretation and intention of these regulations prior to implementation. I know Mr. Kerber talked about that, but I don't think that's in the bill right now. We absolutely, MLFCCA absolutely advocates for in-person checks done frequently on infants and more frequently for the first 4 weeks of care as best practice for safety. This practice, however, should be emphasized during proposed revised safety training. Work to eliminate providers putting children in unsafe sleep environments is what we have to work on, not these frequent checks. We want frequent checks, but to add a layer of another layer of legislation that really cannot be enforced is going to be difficult on for many levels that you'll hear from other folks on. There's also no documentation, no research that supports there'll be less SIDS deaths if they're checked on. SIDS deaths happen. Okay, to wrap up, we do definitely support Section 18 with amended wording. All county licensors will be instructed by Department of Human Services to accept licensing training hours from all Minnesota Center for Professional Development approved training, including an online format such as Eager to Learn and a relationship-based professional development format such as MLFCCA mentoring. Right now, licensors are just all over the board of what they'll accept for training, and that's just not working. And also that the increased training requirements are absolutely not implemented until Department of Human Services has proven accessibility to required training statewide. That's a big problem.
Thank you
very much for your time.
Thank you for helping us out here by not repeating what we are saying. And you did very good. And
I heard your additional points.
So thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Would you introduce yourself? And I'm losing track of my list here. So if you'll just introduce yourself and orient me to where you're coming from.
Probably not. There's a handout as well.
I believe I emailed that to everyone a couple days ago. But
so this is Holly, correct?
Thank you. Yes.
Holly Saville?
Yes. My name is Holly Saville, and I'm a licensed.
Saville, thank you.
That's okay. And I'm a licensed family child care provider in St. Michael. I'm also president of the Wright County Family Child Care Association. And I'm also an approved trainer for early childhood professionals. So I also plan our training for our county association. So I feel I can offer three different perspectives of this bill. I reiterate what everyone else has said already. We're very much in favor of protecting children and reducing the risk of SIDS, preventing deaths when we can. I think that there's many aspects of this bill that do not really that aren't going to do anything to reduce the risks and are increasing the amount of stress that providers are going to have to face, the cost, because trainings, you know, minimum trainings are $18 for a two-hour training. So we're going to be paying, you know, almost $100 more per year just in – or $200 more per year just to take these extra trainings. You know, I just encourage you to slow down and not push this forth to the next committee so they can discuss it. Can you know, it'd be nice to actually work out the problems with this bill before pushing it forward. As a trainer, increasing the hours to 16 under Section 18 would benefit me. It would mean more business for me. As a provider, it would hurt my business. And I speak for 450 licensed family child care providers in Wright County when I say that they are not in favor of increasing our training hours. It does not guarantee that the quality of care is going to be any better. I'm currently working on my master's in early childhood, but I'm not making major changes to my program because of that. Parents have a choice where they put their children. I have questions about Section 12, the word practicable. If providers take children on walks and strollers, I want to make sure that practicable doesn't mean that after 30 minutes, if that baby has fallen asleep in a stroller, they have to bring everyone home. It leaves a lot of gray area for interpretation, and as we've noted, there's not consistency across counties. I also want to make sure that swaddling in safe swaddling devices is not outlawed. Both of my boys were colicky, had gluten allergies, and I was very fortunate if they slept for 15 to 45 minutes. I kid you not. But swaddling them sure helped a lot. And because talking about soft blankets being removed, I just want to make sure that swaddling is not removed. I agree with Section 15 that those frequent checks are just horrible. Line 11.4 mentions all hours of care. I think it's supposed to be all hours of sleep. So let's make sure that we aren't required to have monitoring devices on the children for all hours of care. Insurance, please do not require that. I tell providers they need to have it. It's very important. I carry a $3 million policy, which is way above the max. But I don't think government should be telling people every detail of their businesses.
I'm going to have to ask you to choose one more unspoken to point, if there is one on your list.
Section 18, like I said, increasing the training hours, I think, is a bad thing. And increasing CPR, right now we're required to take it for every 3 years. You're reducing that to every 2 years, reducing first aid to every 2 years. First aid trainings do not change. I've taken more than 11 of them over my 25 years caring for children. There's no difference. Also requiring us to take behavior guidance trainings every single year and supervision trainings every single year. A lot of these things are common sense. And there's only so many behavior guidance trainings offered. I offer one. It's not like there's a plethora of them out there. So I encourage you not to limit us so much and increase these already burdensome regulations. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And our next testifier is Lisa Thompson and then Hattie Brown.
Madam Chair, please. Members of the committee, my name is Lisa Thompson, and I'm very fortunate to be in good company with some very well-researched other providers interested in this topic. I'm a licensed family child care provider on the east side of St. Paul, and I'm also president of Child Care Providers Together, AFSCME Local 3400. And I'm pretty sure in all of the years I've been working in this field that family child care is often the first and sometimes the only choice for families throughout the state. The rules and regulations and laws that guide our businesses are front and center to child care providers, so you can imagine this bill is very important to us. The bill makes some very important and helpful changes for family child care, but there are other changes this bill will make that are very concerning to our members. Some of the points have already been brought up, and I was trying to make some quick notes to not repeat some things. Some of the things that weren't mentioned that I think are very important is that video training. If we're going to increase training requirements for repetitive things, such as was mentioned a few minutes ago here, such as CPR and a consistent, a standard curriculum, that video training be allowed. It's very cumbersome for many providers across the state, especially in rural areas, to attend in-person trainings. CPR and first aid is a acceptable practice to be recertified by video. And it is written in law to be allowed already, but the way that it's written, licensors can choose to not allow it. This really puts providers in a pickle. Another thing is that wasn't quite mentioned is that the more we regulate, the less intuitive care that providers are able to give. Relying more on documentation and trying to find regulation. And where really good, high-quality care happens is our intuition in what a child needs and what a child needs on any particular day or any given moment. And we have to remain focused on our intuition and caring for a child, using our expertise and drawing on good training practices and following the recommended best practices in the care that we do. And by more teaching and more mentoring and coaching of providers, that will be a very important piece for us. One of the other things that wasn't...
Thompson, I would like if you could wrap up now. We're trying to keep moving very quickly. So
absolutely. Ahead. I thank the committee for the opportunity to be here to talk today. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Thompson. Hattie Brown. Ms. Brown here? No. And I'm sorry, I came in the middle of it. I believe, Senator, there were several amendments that people had.
She's missing two.
She's not here. Senator Lori, did you want to comment on any of this before you seen the amendments? Do you know what? Or if
I have not seen the amendments, but here's Senator Nelson, so maybe I will very shortly. I do know that the department has been forewarned to some extent. I don't know if they've seen the final versions, and I know there's some things that are agreeable at this point that can probably help this bill. I will.
Mr. Chair?
Nelson, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senator Lori. First, I wanted to thank Mr. Kerber. I do think this bill has really come a long way. I attended one of those meetings in Rochester, and I was extremely impressed with the level of competency that I saw both from the providers and from the department now as I see the common sense way these things have been addressed. So I just want to note and thank you for that. With that, there are a couple amendments that I would like to offer. I'll start with the A1 or the A4 amendment, members.
We have the A3
distributed. Why don't you explain it while it is?
The A4 amendment, I believe, is one additional area that has been agreed upon by the department and the providers. It looks like Senator Lori needs a copy of that amendment. And it simply adds a few lines after line 34 on page 10. It would be section 15. It would be inserting a new section. And it has to do with family child care diapering area disinfection. And it simply specifies what, in addition to bleach, we call this the bleach amendment, I guess, can be used to disinfect those areas. And I'll let Mr. Kerber, and I believe this was also offered and accepted in the House last night, if I'm not mistaken.
We had the A3 handed out. The A4 is being handed out.
Mr. Chair, I start with the easy ones first.
Okay. On the A4 amendment, Mr. Kerber.
Mr. Chair and members, Jerry Kerber again. The A4 amendment is dealing with an issue that sort of represents kind of what we heard a lot about when we held community meetings, and we've been engaged with providers over the last year a lot. And we've heard a lot of frustrations, and some of those frustrations were about the Department of Human Services, believe it or not. And so one of the areas that there's a lot of discussion about is the requirement that people use bleach to clean up the diapering area after fecal accidents and what have you. There are other products that have been put on the market since the early 70s when this regulation came out. And so this is an area where some counties allow a variance and some counties don't allow a variance. And so in talking with providers, it just seemed to make some sense. Why don't we just clarify it in the law and be done talking about bleach for a while and move on to some other issues. And so this is something that we like.
Senator Lori, any comments? If not, any K-4 further?
K-4 would be a friendly amendment.
We decided we might change the word on line 9 from produce to product, maybe.
I accept that as a friendly correction, Mr. Chair.
I know produce works, too. But
Thank
Senator
you,
Nelson
Mrs.
incorporates,
White.
She incorporates product instead of produce. On the amendment as modified, any discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. The A3, the next one you're doing? Or?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to offer the A3 amendment as well. This was addressed earlier in the testimony regarding clarifying the age as far as saying younger than the age of 1 year. This is on page 9, line 19. And then it also talks about subdivision 10 inserting after line 22 on page 17. A subdivision 10, which talks about the approved training. And I do believe this was also an agreed upon further clarification for the bill.
Mr. Chair?
I think in that amendment to the first word of it, you shouldn't be striking the up to and including just the word up to. You probably just strike the and including, don't you? Because otherwise it says serving infants 12 months of age. Is it, St. Council?
Otherwise, only 12 months.
918.
No, Mr. Chair, I think the amendment
okay.
is correct.
Is okay? Oh, I didn't see. I'm sorry. I didn't see that. I'm sorry. I missed the rest. I apologize.
Yes.
Okay. Discussion on the amendment.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Benson and Senator Hoffman.
Okay. Mr. Chair, it had been mentioned by one of the providers that they would like the county licensing staff trained prior to implementation of the new requirements. And so if Senator Nelson is amenable, if we could discuss amending on the A3 amendment, line 13, after the period, before the period prior to implementation of these requests. Let me try that again. The commissioner must train on the interpretation prior to implementation. So before the period, insert the words prior to implementation.
Is Senate Counsel, did you have comment on this?
Mr. Chair and Senator, I'm not sure if the paragraph B takes care of your concern. It indicates that the new and increased training requirements must not be imposed on providers until the commissioner establishes statewide accessibility.
And Mr. Chair and Ms. White, I think that refers to the availability of CPR, the availability of the behavioral training, not to the people who will be coming in and checking to see if the training's been completed, which I think was the concern of one of the testifiers, that sometimes the county staff isn't quite up to speed. And they come in, and it's kind of OJT, and it's tough on the providers. So,
Senator Benson, are you moving this amendment, or is this?
I would like to move this amendment.
On the amendment to the amendment, Mr. Kerber.
Mr. Chair, members, that's consistent with what we're looking at with this amendment. I think the issue was from providers is to be sure that if we have a whole new set of regulations that are coming out, that the that the people that they're dealing with who are going to be enforcing them have had the training on what are these regulations and what do they mean. So I think that it's reasonable. I think we're okay with that.
Mr. Chair, I accept that as a friendly amendment to my
okay.
A3.
Caves. Is Sir Hoffman on the amendment to the amendment or no?
It's on the amendment. It's on 59A3. Well,
let's deal with the amendment to the amendment first. Any further discussion? St. Collins, to read the amendment, please.
Mr. Chair and members, 1.13 before the period, insert prior to implementation.
Further discussion on that? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. On the Nelson Amendment as amended, Senator Hoffman.
Subdivision 10, 1.5, Mr. Chair, thank you. County licensing staff must accept the non-permissive language training approved by the Minnesota Center for Professional Development. That's something, my understanding is it's solely proprietary to Metro State University. That's who handles that. That kind of professional development. There are other organizations out there, and I mentioned a few of them, like Applebaum's, ATI, NACRA, which is the Child Care Resource and Referral Network, does some. I guess it's – is there a reason why, Senator Nelson, that we just picked the Minnesota Center for Professional Development, or is there – are you – would you be open to saying other – there's a tons of them out there, and especially in the state of Minnesota, that do this stuff, so –
Mr. Chair and Senator Hoffman, I will defer to Mr. Kerber or to Katie to discuss that particular element of why Minnesota Center for Professional Development is what is listed here.
And it's not excluding any others. You're just saying they have to accept this one.
Mr. Chair.
Yes. Mr. Kerber?
Mr. Chair, that's correct. It's not excluding others. This is, again, trying to address a situation where there was inconsistent acceptance of various training. And so this is trying to clarify that if it's training that has been approved by them, that it's going to be good. But I think we can get some other clarification.
Mr. Chair, I there are so many gatekeepers out there. I mean, there was Concordia University was part of one that did it with kids with special health care needs. There's, I mean, if you want, I can produce a list of probably 20 of them in 5 minutes. And I just, as soon as you isolate one, you're excluding, not by default, just by putting it in there. I think the Child Care Resource and Referral Network has a pretty good idea of who those folks are. I would rather see language like approved by either the National Association of the Child Care Resource and Referral Network folks or what do they call it? It used to be the Greater Minneapolis Daycare Center. Now it's in St. Paul. It's called something. But I know what they do.
I'm not sure who was first.
Go ahead.
Okay, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, committee members, and Ann McCauley is here from Child Care Aware as well, so if I say anything wrong, she'll correct me. Oh, now you're over here. Okay. Child Care Aware already only provides training that is approved by the Minnesota Center for Professional Development. We actually asked for this language to increase the availability of training in Greater Minnesota, especially because we have licensors that are not allowing any kind of online training, and that is approved by Minnesota Center for Professional Development. There's no word solely in here. So they can also still approve training out that is not approved by Minnesota Center for Professional Development. The way this is written, as I understand it.
In effect, the child care center home is guaranteed that the program they use, that they can use it if it's approved by here, and they want that because some of the counties are saying, no, you can't use those.
Mr. Chair, if I may, you have the Early Childhood TA Center at the University of North Carolina at Frank Porter Graham that provides a whole series of professional development training series, and I know they actually have a partnership with the Pacer Center here in Minnesota. And it just seems, and when I see language like must, it gets away from, it becomes to me almost non-permissible. So I'm not comfortable with that just being it from that one spot when I know right here. And you used to be called Child Resources, Inc. years ago. I remember it then. So help me out with that.
Okay. Mr. Chair, Senator Hoffman, Ann McCauley with what is now Child Care Aware of Minnesota, and we are the Child Care Resource and Referral System in Minnesota. Just to clarify that the Center for Professional Development acts as more of a
a clearinghouse to make sure that the trainings that are going to be offered, the trainers and the trainings, are reaching a certain standard of quality. They're actually still delivered by any number of organizations. So they really are. They aren't doing the delivery of the training out of Metro State, out of the center. They're acting as the holding house for clearing to make sure that what we're offering throughout various settings are of a certain quality.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Nelson, did you have...
I think there's no need for further comments. I would just actually encourage Senator Hoffman to continue along looking at if we need to list others that have sort of this expedited approval. But I think the department and the child care providers have worked so hard on this language today that I would ask the committee to approve the amendment as it is, and certainly encourage Senator Hoffman to continue on with further improvements if he thinks that might be necessary.
Further discussion on the Nelson Amendment as amended. If not, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. Thank Next you. Amendment.
Mr. Chair, I have one other amendment. Mr. Chair. Members, this is a oral amendment. So if you could look at Section 15, which is the safe sleep section that we have been discussing. I believe that's on page 11.
It is.
On page 11, yes.
And my amendment is to delete Section 15. And I'd like to just give a few comments about that. We heard a lot of discussion about the importance of safe sleep, and certainly there's I think we all want to do everything we can to prevent SIDS, and any way that we can do that, I think it is something that should be encouraged. And so while I certainly understand the importance of this section, I'm a little bit worried about two things. One, I heard I heard testifiers talking about, well, how is it enforced? I'm not so much worried about how it's enforced. I'm a little bit concerned about how it would be implemented. So I see this as a very important aspect, but I think the way that it's worded right now could lead to some unintended consequences. And, in fact, I almost worry that it would almost be pushing towards only center-based care. And I think that could be very damaging in our society in general. And I love center-based care, don't get me wrong. But I do believe that we need to have options and choices for high-quality care for providers and for parents, particularly in rural areas. And I appreciated Senator Lori. I noticed he was listening intently to the providers on this particular issue. And for not to say that there should not continue to be work on this issue, because I think there should be. I just would like to take it out at this moment so that the rest of the bill that everyone has worked so hard on can continue on its way. And I have great confidence in Mr. Kerber and the department and the child care providers that they will not be negligent in addressing this. And so I would ask that we remove Section 15.
Senator Lori.
Mr. Chair, Senator Nelson, I respect what you're trying to get at here, and I very much would like to have support in moving this bill forward. I'd look at maybe a couple of options. I think that stripping it in this committee kind of does send a statement that we're trying to kill the provision. We could, understanding that this provision does need more work and more attention and more of the stakeholder process that many of us have witnessed. I'd be uncomfortable stripping the provision, but maybe we could instead, as a committee, consider moving the bill without recommendation, with the understanding that this one provision does create such heartburn and needs additional work, and that would allow us the ability to continue working on it. I'd suggest that as a possibility to consider, and we've teased this out on the record now that this is highlighted, and maybe that would be acceptable. I'm just thinking.
Mr. Chair, what I would think I agree with you, although I think we should vote this bill out with recommendation. There's been a lot of work here. So I would like to withdraw my oral amendment and submit a different one that I think may.
Please go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would just for my oral amendment then, on line 11.4, just change the word must to, I guess you'd have to insert the word are encouraged to. So we're changing from must to are encouraged to on line 11.4. And then on line 11.9, after the license holder, strike the word must, but use is encouraged to. And I think, did I miss one maybe on 11.7? Was there a? Every place there's a must.
Yeah, that would be line 7 as well.
Yes. And line 7 and line 12. So we would, I'll trust Ms. White to get the revision correctly. But every time there is a must, we're going to say is encouraged to. However, on the last subdivision 2, regarding the monitoring, that still is a must. So on line 12, I would make that still mandatory. And I hope that gets to where we're trying to go here. And I know that providers, businesses in general, when the legislature says is encouraged to, believe me, they try and meet that standard. So that would be my oral amendment. And, Mr. Chair, do we need Ms. White to read that
Senator
back?
Senator Nelson withdrew her previous motion and proposed on lines 4, 7, and 9 of page 11 to strike must. And the first case, insert are encouraged, and the other two is encouraged to. Are encouraged to and is encouraged to in the other, in the
yes.
second third.
Yes.
Is that what you intend?
Yes.
Senator Nino on that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Nelson, on line 12, there was a concern expressed by one of the testifiers about what that would mean and literally all hours of care. For example, if I was an in-home care provider for three toddlers and I took them on a trip to the park, do I have to bring a baby monitor and plug it in so that I'm monitoring them somehow? You know, there's concerns there.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Nelson.
I actually thought we took care of that, but if we did officially, I will at this point in my oral amendment, which is line 11.14, during all hours of sleep. And I understood that was the intent of the legislation. So let's make that official in my amendment.
Incorporate that into your previous.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
So the line 11.4 instead of must would be are encouraged to. Line 7 instead of must is encouraged to. Line 9 instead of must is encouraged to. And line 14, care is stricken and the word sleeping inserted. Senate Counsel. She's thinking about another possible change. Is there a discussion on that?
Mr. Chair, I think this goes a long way to keep the provision and the conversation alive. It's probably still not perfect, but I appreciate that and would consider it a friendly amendment to this point, and we will continue the stakeholder engagement and understand, even if we didn't get all hours of sleeping perfect either, we will continue to work on that as well. I had already taken note of that, and we will continue our stakeholder engagement process and consider this oral amendment a friendly amendment.
Thank you, Senator.
Senator Nelson, Senate Counsel, thinks you might want to strike the word care on line 10 and replace it with the word sleeping.
Correct. Very good catch.
We will include that in the thing, and Senator Laurie thinks this is a
no,
not
that
perfect.
One pushes me over the top.
Yes. On the motion. Everybody understand the Nelson motion. If so, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. Further amendments? Further discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Nino.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I am going to offer a change on lines 9.6 and 9.7. I'll offer an oral amendment. Reinstate the stricken language, and after that language, insert
you
the word.
The page and line.
I'm not sure where we are, Mr. Chair.
9.6 and 9.7.
Thank you.
Reinstate the stricken language, and after that language, insert the word or. This goes back to a bill that we had heard previously. Senator Laurie, I don't know if you were, this was during the health exchange tour you were doing through various committees, so you might not have been in our committee at the time, but we did hear a bill. I don't know if maybe it was Senator Eaton's bill, but we did hear a bill that basically did the same thing, and I expressed a number of concerns that in doing this, we completely eliminate parental discretion and authority over their child care. We require them to get permission from a third party in order to make directions for sleeping arrangements for their own child in this particular establishment. I found that problematic, so I'm that's the purpose of the amendment, Mr. Chair.
Discussion on the amendment. Senator Eaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, when we send our kids to school or to any government organized or any kind of a, even a play area, there are regulations, and they are even in a one of those play gyms, you have to take your shoes off. They have to clean the mats off. I mean, there are things that have to be done to protect everybody, and I think that requiring a safe sleeping position is a pretty minimal requirement. In fact, most people would appreciate it.
Further discussion, Mr. Kerber.
Mr. Chair, you know, we spent, and Senator Nino, we spent a lot of time talking about this issue, and certainly we understand those concerns. I think the one point that I would want to make here is that we're not looking at this as interfering really with a parent's desire, because if a parent, you know, really wants their child to sleep in an alternative position, they can more than likely get a physician to sign off on it. And we are aware over the last 10 years or so that there have been two cases where an infant died and they had the parental permission. And so out of those 65 that died in an unsafe sleep arrangement, 63 of those parents didn't consent to that arrangement. Two of them did. And there are some other circumstances around those. And so this is really not an attempt to focus on taking the authority away from parents, but to emphasize the significance of that decision to sleep a child in an alternative position. It's for those other parents that didn't get a choice in there.
Further discussion. Senator Nino.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This very well may not be an attempt to take away parental authority, but that's what it does. That's absolutely what it does. What this requires is that I must request permission from some other person in order to do what I might want to do. Now, I understand it's a good thing, but also this has changed over the years, and I will tell my story again that I told when this bill was up before. You know, I've had a number of children, so I've had a lot of parenting experience in different scenarios. And I had a child at the time when the proposed protocol, if you want to call it, was to have the children sleeping on their side. That was one of the recommendations. And I had a daughter that, for her, that was problematic. Nobody knew why, but it was bad. She cried. She couldn't sleep when she was on her side. As it turned out, she had a broken clavicle. Now, I and her mother knew that there was a problem, that there was something wrong. But the doctor wouldn't have signed off on a change in protocol because there was no medical reason to do it. But I knew. And it's those circumstances that I don't want to interject government between a parent and their child. And that's why I'm proposing this. I just think I understand what we want to do. I really do. You know, I've as these recommendations have changed over the years, I've tried to follow them because there's nothing worse than a parent losing a child. I get that, but I don't want to interject government between the parent and the child. And so that's my purpose, Mr. Chair.
Further discussion on the Nino motion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion does not prevail. Further discussion on the bill? If not, Senator Lori, moves Senate File 1159 be recommended to pass and re-referred to finance.
As amended.
As amended. Four amendments. On that motion, any further discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails.
Hallelujah. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And with that, this committee has met the first deadline. Yay. This meeting is adjourned.